This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation.
This week on Meet & Three, meet four of our HRN Hall of Fame inductees. These prolific individuals are writers who have changed the way we talk about food. We'll take a look at the journeys that shaped their literary voices.
I was heading off into the unknown to spend my junior year of college in Paris.
We'll explore the culinary landscape they work within.
You know, it was that whole self-made American idea that you can just kind of create a new world from scratch, including a new way of eating.
And look at the transformative effect that their work has on what we eat and where it comes from.
It gets down to management deciding that humane handling is important. You've got to have management that cares. And if management doesn't care, then you're going to have a bunch of bad stuff.
You can learn more about HRN's 10th anniversary Hall of Fame at heritageradionetwork.org/Hall of Fame. And don't forget to subscribe to Meet & Three wherever you listen to podcasts. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I feel like if you're going to go on your own and really take the risk and do something, you have to make it count. And I'm not going to say by any means that we're going to change the world or change the industry. But if you're not going to try, then what's the point? Yeah. We wanted to set ourselves up for an opportunity where we could actually try to do something different and better and try to make an impact. And, you know, it comes down to every aspect of it. You can't just look at, we have better hospitality, we do a better job with the diners. It's
yeah.
like, we profit share with our dishwashers. Like, right now, we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we profit share with our whole staff. Like, all these little things to say, like, we're going to do everything we can to make all of our lives better.
That is Chef Dave Barron of Dialogue Restaurant and the soon-to-open Pajoli in Santa Monica, California, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I'm here once again, as we are more and more this summer, with a mystery guest. Say hello, mystery guest.
Hello, I am the mystery guest.
What are the clues we can give? Our mystery guest is based in Chicago, Illinois.
That is true.
You are the restaurateur of how many restaurants?
I currently have 19 restaurants.
Okay, that for anybody who pays attention should probably answer the question. You won an award this year.
I did win an award this year.
What award did you win this year?
My partner and I won the 2019 Outstanding Restaurateur at the James Beard Awards.
Belated congratulations.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You threw one of the after parties for the James Beard Awards.
We threw a ruckus after party after the James Beard Awards.
Okay.
That I'm still hungover from.
Exactly. So if that doesn't give it away, I have no more clues. This is Kevin Bame of Boca Restaurant Group. We're in an undisclosed location. The reason for that will be revealed in the coming months. Can I say that much?
You can.
I didn't get us in trouble.
I love that. It's okay. So mysterious.
Okay. I'm not going to say even what state we're in. We're either in Illinois or New York.
You know, it makes me feel like we're on the set of the movie Misery.
Ooh.
Do you got some of that going on?
Are you
going to
hobble
right
me later? Are you going to break my... Are you going to break my ankles? Well,
my advice is to not get in an accident into an embankment.
It never works out well.
Yeah.
It never works out well. Okay. The reason I asked you, this was fortuitous that we ended up being together today. We had
it
plans
is.
To be together. And then I was editing this week's show. Our guest is Dave Barron. Dave spent years, certainly his formative professional years in Chicago.
He did.
He was at Alinea Restaurant, rose to the level of chef de cuisine at that restaurant, and then was the chef for a couple of years of Next, which is, for people who don't know, it's another Grant Achatz, Nick Kokonis restaurant, which every 4 months would change its entire theme. They would do
yes.
menus based on Japanese kaiseki. They would do a tribute to El Bulli. They would do childhood was one theme. They did
yes.
a Boku's Door menu. They did a Sicilian menu. So it was like you could get whiplash going from one to another.
You could. It's a brilliant concept.
And Dave was the captain of that ship, and that takes quite some talent.
He was the captain of that ship.
Dave is the chef of Dialogue Restaurant, which has been a very well-reviewed restaurant in Santa Monica, California. And he is about to open. The date is a little uncertain, but sometime in the next month, month and a half, 2 months, a new restaurant called Pajoli, a classical French restaurant, also in Santa Monica. If you follow his Instagram feed, there are currently pictures of it reaching the home stretch of the construction phase. So we're all looking forward to seeing that when it debuts.
And going way back in time, Linea opened in 2005. Boca opened in 2003. For those of you who don't know, they are neighbors. I pulled up to Boca Restaurant Group in 2005. And at the time, really, there wasn't a lot of long-form journalism happening for food in Chicago at that time. But there was a column in Chicago Magazine called Dish. And I remembered reading it right before service. And it said, Linea's home is 1723 North Halsted. Or we were 1723 North Halsted, two doors down, whatever that is, 1729 North Halsted. And we were so excited that they were going next door to us.
Yeah.
And I knew Dave at that point. Dave was a customer. He worked at MK, would come into the restaurant. I believe he staged with us once. And I think at the bar, and he might have mentioned this in your interview, that he asked me what he should do.
Yeah, when he was at a crossroads. We won't say exactly what that moment was, but that moment is in this interview. And I was editing the interview yesterday, and I was getting ready to come meet you at our undisclosed location.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, I gotta hit Kevin up to join me for the intro. So just tell me, how do you remember him as a young buck back in those very exciting days in Chicago dining?
Yes. Well, first of all, I was also a young buck.
Yes.
So I think we were similar creatures, which was incredibly enthusiastic about dining almost mm-hmm. to an obsessed level.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he really thought about. I think that what he did back then was bike, hang out with his girlfriend and restaurants. And I don't think there was anything outside of that circle, which mm-hmm. is pretty much my life at that point, which was just family and restaurants. So he would come in and we would just talk about chefs and restaurants.
Yeah.
And where it was going to go. I think Dave's probably the same exact way now.
Yes, that comes across in the interview. Although I always thought of him as a runner, but I guess he's traded that mainly in now for a bike.
I think it's running and biking. Yes.
Is it unusual for you to have a friendship like that with, you know, it's funny because you spoke at the Welcome Conference 2 years ago.
I did.
And that's, for people who don't know, that's a conference, you know, broadly speaking, it's about the front of the house. It's a hospitality conference. You're going to be, what's the term we use? Co-producing, co-hosting,
yeah,
the one that's the first out of New York one this next month in Chicago?
Yeah, Donnie Medea and I from One Off Hospitality are hosting the show in Chicago, which is September 23rd.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because there have been so many chef conferences over the last 20 years. And then the Welcome Conference happened. And I often think when I'm at that Welcome Conference, I think this is so different in every way from the chef conferences I go to. Do you tend to have many friends who are chefs?
Absolutely.
You do?
Yeah. It's a small, tight-knit community, and so you look around the city and, yeah, you know, I'm friends with Mindy Siegel, and
mm-hmm.
I'm friends with Carrie Nahabedian, and so we just kind of run in the same circles. And,
yeah.
And I like chefs.
Uh-huh.
I mean, restaurant people are just kind of my people.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being young and being 10 years old and wanting to be a restaurateur.
Yeah.
At that point, I didn't know really what that meant.
Yeah.
But I knew that I eventually wanted to find people that felt the same way I did about mm-hmm. restaurants. Mm-hmm. And when I first met those people, then the first one was this guy named Scott Alderson who had worked at Stars in San Francisco. And I was like, I've met my people.
Yeah.
You know, they were generous. They were fun.
Yes.
They were ambitious.
Yes.
I just like chefs.
Yeah.
And they're crazy. And I did inventory of all my friends recently, and they're all left of center.
Even the restaurateur ones.
Including you, Andrew.
Including me? I'm flattered. No one thinks of me that way.
You're left of center.
I usually think of myself as like the calm center of any group of industry people I'm hanging out with.
You think you're straight down the fairway?
You don't think so?
You have terrible self-awareness.
Really? Wow. I take this as a compliment. This is music to my ears.
No, I love weirdos and chefs are a lot.
Weirdo. You're calling me a weirdo?
Yeah, well,
I would
in
take
a good
it.
Way. In a really
no
good
one's
way.
Ever said this to me.
We are company.
I've always said I'm like the Richie Cunningham in a sea of Arthur Fonzarelli's, you know. No, because once in a while I'll meet someone outside the industry and sometimes run into them, you know, out when I'm socializing with industry people.
Yeah.
And I can see a moment. If it's a friend of mine, like I use the word civilian, if it's someone who's not a food writer, not in the restaurant business, and they'll see me out with these groups sometimes, and they're like, I see them flash in the eyes, and it means, what's Andrew doing with these guys? He's going to get into trouble tonight.
You know, our company's an interesting one because we do all of our projects have a chef partner who's attached to it.
Yeah.
So not only do I have Rob Katz, who's my, you know, mm-hmm. my best buddy and my business partner, but then I have these six chef partners who we become, you know, we've got to know very intimately. You
yes.
know, I'm friends with all of them. And you know, I like them for all different ways.
Yes. That's great. Okay. Well, thank you for before I leave it, what's you got any news you want to share? What are you excited about these days, either Boca Group specifically or Chicago generally?
I like to keep things always on the horizon so I can get excited about them. That's mm-hmm. one of the things that kind of drives me. Obviously, the Welcome Conference is coming up September 23rd. Legendary Steppenwolf Theater in Lincoln Park.
Theater that's produced a lot of the great, John Malkovich started there and Gary Sinise. And,
absolutely. Yeah. Joan Allen, mm-hmm. John Malkovich, or John Mahoney, mm-hmm. it goes on and on.
Yeah.
John Mahoney's great. He was the greatest guy, the late John Mahoney. He was
a
wonderful, wonderful man. But also, we're opening Girl and the Goat in downtown Los Angeles.
Fabulous.
And that's coming in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other mysterious projects.
Yes, that you're not going to keep close to the vest. Yeah, yes, as you should. All right. Well, thanks for joining me for the intro. And with that, I'm going to turn this over. And I have to say, by the way, you'll hear in the beginning of the interview, this interview was held on a very dramatic day in New York City maybe 2 months ago. And finding a location was something that needed to be addressed at the last minute. And Hillary Sterling, the chef of Vic's Restaurant in the NoHo neighborhood of New York, who wasn't at the restaurant that night, I think she was actually out of the state, but arranged for us to meet in her office just so we could have a quiet space to interview. You will hear some background noise in the interview. That is actually the dish pit. The dishwashing station was right outside the door. But Hillary, if you're listening to the show, a huge thank you. You'll hear in the opening minutes of this interview why we were left stranded and in need of a space at the last minute. But a huge thanks to Vic's Restaurant and to Hillary for helping us out. And with that, here's my interview with Chef Dave Barron, recorded several weeks ago in New York City. Here you go. Can we just talk about this day in New York?
Yeah, it's been all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, this won't air for a few weeks, but this was the day. I'm sure everyone in the country knows about it because I had some phone calls this afternoon. There was a helicopter crash in New York City, in Manhattan.
The building where Bernadette's in.
Is it the actual building? I know they evacuated.
That's what I read online. So according to the New York Post, it's the Bernadette's
building. Okay. So they were evacuated. They're not open tonight. We were supposed to meet at 3:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
As we sit here, it's a couple minutes before 8 p.m. You're here for a day, basically, day and a bit, and we couldn't get to each other.
No. I left work Saturday and after service, took a red eye here, got here yesterday.
Yeah.
Did a little R&D trip for food.
Nice.
Today, I've been trying to meet up for the last, 6 hours, and here we are.
Crazy. We have cocktails because we've earned them.
I've taken a lot of trains in the last 2 days, more so than I've ever taken in LA in my entire tenure there. I just ride my bike, so either way.
Do you not run anymore?
I mean, I try, but lately it's been all biking.
Okay.
You get a lot more exposure, and I'm trying to connect with understanding what LA is. And so in 2 hours, I can accomplish a lot more on a bike than I can on a running.
You mean you can cover more territory?
Yeah, I can hit, 40 miles in 2 hours as opposed to 12.
Wow. Let's go back. Let's get in the time machine. You're a creature of the Midwest.
Ish?
Yeah. No?
Well, so, okay. I was born in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Because that's where the nearest hospital was.
Oh.
Because we lived in Upper Michigan, in the UP. Like, real Upper Michigan. Not like when people from Detroit say Upper and they mean, Traverse City. We lived in Ironwood, Michigan.
Yeah.
Where my dad had his first teaching job.
Yeah.
And then he, myself, and my mom, when I was two-ish, too young to remember, moved to Marquette, where he got his second teaching job at Northern Michigan University.
Okay.
And then my parents separated. My dad and I moved to upstate New York, and my mom moved to Southwest Michigan.
You went with your dad?
Yeah.
Interesting. So, unusual.
Dad and I, and then eventually stepmom came into the picture.
Okay.
And we lived in Syracuse, where he was a professor for 25 years. School years were in New York, summers were in Michigan with my mom. So it's
this is missing from a lot of your well, online bios.
So my family was from, like, my dad grew up in Flint. So he's a Midwesterner.
Okay.
And, you know, when you work at a place where the chef is from Michigan.
Yeah.
And you're only like 6 years difference in age and you also have a Michigan backstory, it's a great story to tell at the restaurants.
Got it.
And it's not an incorrect story, but you start, right.
It's,
you know.
It's a selectively edited story.
Sure. And yeah, like,
but it's not false.
Yeah. And when I start talking about like my childhood and creating dishes, they correlate. If it's, you know, like if I do a Michigan fall for a dish, it makes sense that we're doing a Michigan fall dish because, you know, Atkins is also from Michigan.
Right.
So it's a better story to tell. And it's not untrue.
Okay.
But I would say my time was probably until I was 17.
Okay.
My time was school year until my junior high school. It was upstate New York, summers and every other holiday in Michigan.
Did you like one over the other? Take away the... whatever the social piece of it was, just sort of on a, like on an animal level, did you like the climate in one over the other? Did you like just the setting, the topography?
They're kind of the same. If you think about upstate New York, a lot of people don't, like people from New York City think of upstate New York and they think like Hudson Valley. But if you think of like the Finger Lakes, you have like hills and leaves and lakes, and it's not that different than parts of Michigan.
And it can get really freaking cold.
It's so cold. Yeah. More snow there than at
and
my
the,
mom's house.
And the snow can last all winter, the way, you know, like on the ground.
It once snowed on my birthday in June.
In June? When's your birthday? My birthday's in June.
June 3rd.
Okay. Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you.
You just had a birthday.
I'm old. No, I mean, I think...
Consider your audience before you say that.
I feel old. I liked New York from the sense of, I mean, I played hockey. I loved lacrosse.
Yeah.
Like, I loved... that every time I went back to Michigan for the summer and met my Michigan friends, I always felt like they hadn't caught up yet. Like I knew something cooler that they were going to find out in a year.
Interesting.
And then when I moved to Michigan for my junior and senior of high school, I felt that way until after I moved. And so I always liked New York more, but I think it's just because I had more formidable time there.
Okay.
Like, if I lived in Michigan and visited New York for the summer,
sure,
and all of my attachments to, like, the things I loved were in Michigan, I probably would have liked that more.
What, did you ever get to, like, the nearest, like when you were upstate New York, did you ever get yourself, like, did you come down to Manhattan at all when you were a kid?
No, my first time in New York City was one of my pathetic college spring break moments when everyone did something cool. Between my, I think it was my sophomore year, I had a friend that I went to college with, and her sister lived in Manhattan and had an apartment here.
Yeah.
And my friend Laura was like, you can crash at my sister's apartment if you want to go there. She's always traveling. She'll leave you the keys. And I'd met her sister a couple times. We were friends. And that was my first time here. And she like left me her Nokia cell phone so that I could like find my way and call her if I got lost. And I just, it was in Brooklyn Heights, right by the promenade. Is that right?
Promenade. Yeah.
And, so I had a paper train map, and I took the train into the city, and I just remember walking around, and there weren't camera phones, it was like a Nokia, whatever. So I just remember with a little pocket camera thing, thinking like, that's Rockefeller Center, and that's Times Square, and you know, and then as soon as I did it once, I started coming back more and more. And so when I was in Chicago, as soon as I could afford it, you could take a flight on Southwest for like $120 if you caught it right. And so we'd fly here super early on a Sunday morning or a Monday morning, and you'd fly back Wednesday at like 9 a.m. because you'd be to work by 10:30 or 11.
Right. Wow, you know? That's so cutting it close.
You literally leave the airport.
Counting on that 1 hour time difference.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Like, because it was 3 hours here, but 1 hour back.
Yeah, right, sure.
And you fly into Midway, and there's no traffic, and you take the train right to work.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, 35 minutes?
You felt super cool. You're like, I just flew back from New York.
Yeah. Sunglasses. I'm picturing like sunglasses and a bomber jacket.
Oh yeah, and you'd save all your money for like, you know, however many months as a cook, so that you could fly here to eat one dinner, and crash on someone's couch in like Harlem.
Yeah,
and then fly back.
You just said you've turned over to biking, but you were a big runner. You're a marathoner.
Yeah, that came late. I grew up playing hockey, so I think I got my first pair of skates when I was like 18 months old. In Upper Michigan.
You're not being cute. That's like for real.
Yeah, no, you live in Marquette, Michigan, or Ironwood at that point.
Okay. It's like learning to walk.
Yeah, I mean, you have ice in your yard from when you're like
Okay.
From like September to June, right?
Right.
You can skate all year round. And so, okay. And my dad played hockey at Michigan State. You know, I didn't have a choice.
Okay.
Not that I wanted a choice, but I didn't have a choice. So like, I was playing hockey at like 5, I think, ish. Maybe, I don't really remember when I started, but as long as I can remember, I played hockey.
Yeah.
And we moved to New York, I played hockey, and then I got into lacrosse. But hockey was like it. Like, I, to the point where I, to the, I guess, not excitement of my dad, picked my college because they gave me more scholarship money to go to. Like, instead of picking the good school or the right school or whatever I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, dad being a college professor is like, this is how you choose things. I could have gone to so many schools for free because of a Syracuse thing, and instead I picked a school to play hockey at.
But what kind of kid, were you? Like, were you a, it sounds like you were pretty, social?
Ish?
You had,
I don't know.
Did you have like a circle of good, like, close friends? Or?
I think I had groups that I wanted to hang out with, but like, I was really into sports.
Mm-hmm.
I was really into art.
What kind of art?
I don't know. Like, I used to chase graffiti around all over Syracuse. There's a really good graffiti scene, so I'd like convince people to drive me so I go take pictures of it.
But you didn't do any yourself.
I tried. I wasn't good at it, but I tried.
I guess that's not the kind of thing you can take a class in.
Yeah, you know, no one's like, here's these cans of spray paint to work on this. And, you know, I was always afraid to do it anywhere illegal, so they'd be like, oh, here's our friend's back of his house. We're allowed to paint here, like that kind of thing.
What appeals to you about graffiti?
One, it's outside and exposed to everything.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that it was kind of... I mean, obviously, for the most part, it's illegal. And
right. That's why I asked, because from your background, it seems like a complete...
You know, I just...
It like seems to go against the grain of everything you've said up to this moment.
I always loved forever this idea of discovering something that shouldn't be there and knowing that it's there, like a secret kind of thing. Like the book The Secret Garden when I was little was so cool, and I always wanted to run around in the woods and find that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. What else?
And
in that realm?
Just anything. Just like... You know, if it's like a pair of shoes, I want the pair that's a little different that no one else has, and no one knows what they are until they know. And then, you know, it's like all little things. Like, I've been like that with cars. I've been like that with everything. Like, there's some little nuance to it that you can't quite figure out, and that's why I like it more than other things. And
so
I think the thing with graffiti was like knowing where it is, knowing what it is, understanding the styles of it, and then being attracted to the ones that were so much better than other ones. Like, my favorite graffiti artist growing up in Syracuse, I... Didn't know who he was in Syracuse. Loved his stuff. I still have all of his photos and stuff. I randomly, thanks to the power of Instagram, like stumbled upon a late, weird, random search. And, you know, you start following different artists, you tag different artists, and you keep clicking.
Yeah.
And he's a graphic designer in Culver City.
Wow.
And so...
Have you met him?
Yeah. We had...
You looked him up or you DM'd him or what'd you do?
Sent him a message, and the message was pictures of his old graffiti.
And he was like, holy crap, it's the guy from Dialogue.
Yeah, well, this is before Dialogue, so
okay.
We had an opening video, not video for Dialogue, but it was just like a 30-second clip of like candles flickering that he made for us because that was going to be the first page on the website. But then as we were researching websites, we realized the more distractions you have early on, the further people don't get into your website. So we didn't end up putting it on there. But
okay.
I mean, we brought him in for friends and family. He's super nice. He's an incredible artist. I guess he's, you know, done some really cool things, doing some like carpool karaoke scenario for Apple TV where he's doing all like the graphic stuff and that. Super nice guy. And I remember sitting there being like, do you know how I used to climb over fences on the, on like Syracuse's campus to get up to the water towers to find that one thing that I heard a rumor from some guy I went to high school with that you painted back here and I had to find it? Like, what made me get arrested is like a 15-year-old jumping over stupid things.
Was that otherwise out of character for you to do that kind of thing?
I always liked exploring and discovering things. Like,
no, but I mean the illegal part of it. Like going into an area where that was forbidden.
Like one time when I was 5, I smoked a cigarette and then I went over and told my dad and I was crying and I was afraid I was going to like go to jail for it.
Yeah.
So I didn't really, it wasn't one.
You were a straight arrow.
I didn't really stir the pot.
Okay. Did you feel a need to?
No.
Yeah.
No, I was always more worried about the repercussion than the excitement of doing it. You know, like everything was always, what is going to be the result of the action I make before I make that action?
So here's a question for you, because that was the kind of kid I was. I'm 51 now. I do that kind of stuff now.
Sure, yeah. You're like,
now I'll take the chance, and
I have 100 on the highway right now.
Yes, I have kids, and like, but now I'll take the chance.
Yeah. You know, I think though that
I'm wondering though, did you have a, you know, I wouldn't have to get specific, but did you have like a delayed phase like that in your life?
No, but I think what happened is I hit a point where I kind of realized I was missing out on a lot of things, for better or for worse. Like, I never fell into the drug phase.
Mm-hmm.
I never fell into I mean, as a college kid who played sports, like, I certainly had the late nights of drinking and
sure.
the early mornings of drinking and the keg races and all that nonsense, like your typical, like,
yeah.
wasn't in a frat, but I may as well have been kind of thing. But I hit a point where towards the end of college, where I was like, I'm going to miss out on all these things all these people do. And so I randomly went on spring break with a bunch of friends that weren't really good friends, but they were just like, hey, we've got a room, a seat in a van. You want to drive down to Panama City Beach with us? And I was like,
oh my God.
Yeah, I'll do it. And the first night I was there, I got my tongue pierced out of nowhere. Super out of character for me. I was just like, wow. Yep. And I took it out like 6 months ago. So
yeah,
I had it for like 17 years.
That's making up for lost time.
Well, we were all sitting there, and it was like the summer of everyone getting eyebrow rings and like shoulder tattoos.
Yeah, but...
And we're, one guy's in the tattoo or the piercing chair, and they're like, he's like, I'll only do it if someone else does. And everyone looks at me, and I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And then as they're like about to do my eyebrows, like, well, if I'm going to get something pierced, it's got to be something unique. So I just got my tongue. I don't know.
Oof.
But that was kind of the point where I was like, I'm going to keep missing out on things unless I just start saying yes to everything.
Right.
And so like anytime right. there was an opportunity to travel, like there was one guy I went to college with and he was like my neighbor. We were kind of friends. Like I knew him because he was my neighbor. He's a really nice guy. And he wanted someone to drive with him back to Arizona to help him get his car back there. I didn't have anything to do. So I was like, sure, I'll go with you. So we drove to Arizona. And then his parents owned a house on an island off the coast of Honduras. And he's like, you want to go there for a week? We're going. I didn't have anything to do. So I was like, yeah, you know what? I will never go to Honduras again.
Yeah.
I don't think this opportunity will ever present itself.
Yeah.
I'll go. And you know what? I got there. They paid off a dive instructor. I scuba dive for 3 days.
Right.
And I'll probably never scuba dive again like that, at least. Not on that reef.
Yeah.
So at some point, I was just like, I can't keep missing opportunities. I'm just going to say yes to everything.
Can I tell you? I'm taking my first guitar lesson this Friday.
That's awesome.
Ever.
I never learned how
it's
to play
weird.
Any instruments.
Yeah.
I love music. We had... My stepdad hit a point where he was doing really well with his company. He sells fire trucks
okay.
in a small town.
So fire trucks?
Yeah, people sell those. Like if you were,
well, what do you mean? You don't mean like little like Tonka trucks?
No,
you
like
mean
Pierce real... fire trucks. Like
wow.
Yes, I know. It's super weird.
Okay.
But he, you know, his dream was always own a piano, and they bought one with like a piano disc, which is like this little computer thing on the bottom,
okay.
and it has the 3.5 floppy disks that you put in to play mm-hmm. because it's like pre CD. Waste opportunity. I wish I would have learned how to play piano. That piano sat in our house for... It's still sitting there. It's this beautiful mahogany baby yeah. grand. I never touched it. I
did
just
you have the inkling? See, I don't know.
Hindsight.
You and I don't. Yeah, but you know, I look back at why I didn't do these kind of things. And honestly, for me, what I've realized is I'm a perfectionist. And I didn't want to go through the messy phase.
Yeah.
I couldn't have put it in those words as a kid, but I didn't want to sit there and be awful in the first lesson and be awful the first time I tried to play a song.
Maybe
but you have
like
to be
the
that.
Embarrassment of not being good at something and people
right.
looking at you being like, you suck at that.
Yes. But you have to go, like, I honestly, I always wanted to do stand-up comedy and I've had friends who have done it, not none of them got famous doing it,
sure.
but they'd gigged around New York and they're, and like, I gave them jokes, you know,
yeah.
but I never wanted to get up and have that sucky first five sets, you know, so I never did it.
I just never wanted to fail at anything.
Yeah.
Like I'll bet.
But failure can be often is a stage in learning to do something new.
Sure.
I mean, it always is unless you're, you know, Mozart.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I mean, when I was little, I had a bicycle.
Right.
And I remember that I was really good at riding no hands. And I would go off the road down this little trail to the back of our house. And I must have been like, we still lived in Michigan, so I had to be like 5.
Yeah.
But I just remember hitting a pine cone and falling off the bike. And to this day, I can't ride no hands.
Right.
Every now and then I like try to teach myself and I want to do it, but I don't want to fall.
Yeah.
So you don't take the risk because you don't want to fail.
Yeah.
You right. know, it's like a hard thing to wrap your head around.
It's
like,
very hard thing
when
to,
is failure
to
okay?
rewire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. You know, I'm a big tennis fan, and Pete Sampras, growing up, had a two-handed backhand.
He was awesome.
And to win Wimbledon, they always said you really needed a one-handed backhand. And he had his sights set on that. So he decided to go to a one-handed backhand. But he had to deal with, as someone who had a really, you know, was doing really well as a junior, losing
mm-hmm.
for a while because he had to take the backhand out for a test drive in match play. Right?
Yeah. But you have to. You have to compete at that level.
You have to be willing to do that, right? And So I'm anyway. So I'm taking my first guitar lesson at 51, but I'm excited about it. But it's taken me this long to be like, yeah, okay, I'm going to suck for a while. How did food come up? Because I know you. Well, first of all, as a kid, where did it figure into your life? Like, what was your family's cultural background? How much did food figure in? Was it even a priority of either dining out or at home? What was the story
there? In my family growing up, there's no good like cultural background story. There's no good like religious background story. There's just like sort of generic family, only my parents were separated, so I'd be either Michigan or New York.
Cultural background? What was the heritage there?
My grandparents on my dad's side are mostly German.
Okay.
On my mom's side, it's like a hodgepodge of everything.
Okay.
I think we thought my grandpa was Sicilian, then my mom did that DNA thing and found out he's not Sicilian at all. And it totally confused her.
Well, so, also Sicilian's so cool.
I know, right? I just roll with it because he gets really tan. So we all just assumed he was Sicilian,
right?
And he would say he was Sicilian.
Yeah,
he's not, or she's not.
Yeah, I don't know, it's all whatever. Confused. Okay, but so you didn't really identify
any way
with it. Yeah,
of, like this is my whatever. I grew up I went to Catholic school until I was in third grade.
Okay,
it's about where that ended.
Okay,
you know, and my grandparents on my dad's side would go to church every Sunday.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there was not, like, an association with anything specific.
I got
specific.
It. Okay. So you're kind of I don't want to say generic.
We'll say generic.
Like a generic American.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, childhood.
Like,
American.
Up, was, like, blonde
do we even
hair, blue
say
eyes.
Suburban? What do we call it? It's more than suburban.
No, I mean, it
rural?
Was...
Rural? No.
We'll go suburban.
Suburban.
That's fine. I mean, Syracuse is big enough.
American, suburban, childhood.
Yeah, like, played the sports you're supposed to, did the thing. I didn't play baseball or football or basketball, but I played hockey and lacrosse.
Yeah.
So
what kind of student were you?
Lazy but good.
Okay.
Like, I definitely wouldn't spend hours studying, but I kind of breezed through things, so I didn't have to.
You were like, this is what I call the easy B student.
I think I got my first B in like eighth grade.
You had A's up until then?
Yeah, because my dad was a college professor, so I wasn't allowed to not get that. Like,
but you didn't have to work that hard for it.
No.
Have you had an IQ test?
No.
Where do you think you'd rate? Pretty high.
I don't know.
Oh, look at this. Susan, look at the smile.
No, so...
He's blushing. You're actually blushing.
Yeah.
I'm guessing way up.
My dad was top
10 percentile.
My dad, he still is... I think he's like a dean of a little college now, but he was a college professor at Syracuse. He was like tenured a couple years in, got his PhD in higher education. So he taught hotel restaurant management.
Yeah.
And he helped with the program at Syracuse. He did Northern Michigan before that. And my grandfather was also a college professor.
Yeah.
But in the engineering side. So the school side was always like an important thing. Like,
yes,
you were failing if it wasn't perfect kind of thing. But also, like, whenever I wanted to see my dad, I would go visit him at work because he was working a lot. And it was either hockey time or I would see him at work for the most part. Because when he was home, it was like watching the hockey game on the sofa or watching sports kind of thing. It wasn't like we didn't hang out and do things. We just, we either, you know, he went to hockey with us and was one of my coaches for a while.
Yes.
Or I'd spend time with him in the kitchen. And so, you know, we always had dinner at the dinner table together. No one ever sat in front of the TV and had dinner. But it was always my stepmom who cooked. Or in Michigan, like, it was kind of a free-for-all because my mom and stepdad worked all the time. So sometimes we'd have dinner together. Sometimes we'd just go out to a neighborhood restaurant.
Uh-huh.
But so I was really comfortable at an early age. Like, one of my first food memories is sitting with my dad in the kitchen at Northern Michigan University, and he'd thrown a bag of mussels in the steamer. The way I remember it, it was like the 10-pound bags you see now. In hindsight, thinking about it, it was probably like two dozen mussels.
One of those two-pound...
Yeah, it was like nothing.
Purple meshy bags.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember him opening the steamer and putting me on a step stool, and I sat next to it on like one of those three-rung step stools, and he stood there, and we ate mussels over the trash can and threw shells in. And then we'd go to like the seafood festival, and I would eat frog legs when I was little. And so there was always that association with a kitchen not being an uncomfortable place. You know, like, I wasn't afraid to stand with the students at 7 years old and make an omelet.
Uh-huh.
Because I had done it. It wasn't scary. It was like, oh, we're going to do this. That's fun. I want to do that with you.
Yeah.
But there was never any intention of like food being a career.
You went to business school.
Yeah, I studied business psych and philosophy.
Yeah.
But I basically went to college to try to play hockey, and then I went to school. So,
did you have dreams of going pro?
Well, when I was 16, I did, and then I blew out my knee the first time. And then it was more dreams of like playing D3. But, you know, it was never, at that point, it's not going to happen. Like, you hit a point where it's, you know, you're not going to. And yeah. So I just enjoyed playing. And when I transferred from New York to Michigan for my last 2 years of high school, the school I went to didn't have like AP classes. So they would just send you to the community college to take classes. So when I started as a freshman in college, I had enough credits to be a sophomore. And all the classes that I took were basically prereqs for everything. So they all transferred in.
Yeah.
So I was able to take a lot of classes and things I was interested in. So I took a couple of photography classes, an art class. I really liked philosophy, so I just kept taking the classes. I liked psychology because I just kept taking the classes, and it was just intriguing. And I figured I needed a business degree.
Why?
Because I wanted to do something and I needed a degree to do it. I didn't know what I wanted to do. It was just a liberal arts school. So.
Did you know that you wanted to maybe own something one day? Did you feel entrepreneurial?
No,
Did you think you wanted to be able to take care of yourself? Really?
Well, I liked the aggression of it. I liked that it wasn't in a place that you had to sit. I just wanted to do things and to be moving around. And in my head, I was like going to sit in that pit and I was going to, you know. I had friends who were traders, and you know, I saw the cool things they were doing. I was like, all right, I'll do that.
Well, what do you mean cool things they were doing?
They had like nice apartments and good jobs.
Yes, right.
And,
well, that's only,
you know,
the only regrets I've ever had about not going that kind of route is the trappings of it.
Sure. And but I also saw that they weren't doing what, you know, like my mom and stepdad own a business, and my mom sits at a desk every day in front of what was a typewriter and is now a computer in the same desk. And I knew I couldn't do that. Right. You know, and I could have seen myself doing like what my dad does in teaching, which is, I think, part of the reason I enjoy being in a restaurant working with cooks. And even the cooks and the chefs who are above me, the ones who are below me, the ones who are with you, like, if you have a skill set to share and have the opportunity to share someone and guide it, like, after I blew out my knee the second time in college, I started helping coach the women's team. Like, it's always been part of my life to, like, work with people to do things, to accomplish goals together, whether it's on a team, whether it's leading a team.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, my first job was at 13. My stepdad decided that I had to get a job because in Michigan at 13, you can be considered farm labor and have a job. But I didn't want to detassel corn, which is what everyone does. You send the back of a pickup truck and you
pull
the tassels.
What's the verb? Detassel.
Yeah, you're a corn detasseler.
I never heard that one.
I didn't want to do that. It sounded terrible. There's bugs in corn, and you're on a pickup truck, and you're in the fields. And his cousin was like the manager of this like hole in the wall diner at a flea market. He's like, fine, you can get a job there washing dishes. So I got a job there washing dishes, and the next summer I got a job there working the takeout window, and the next summer I was the toast boy. The summer after that, I worked the griddle and worked brunch.
Did you like immediately being in a restaurant? Being on a team in a restaurant?
This was a garbage restaurant. Like, there were like three.
No, I get that.
But I like the fun of like being there and doing things and interacting and not sitting somewhere. Because like you're doing dishes and there's something else. Like there's something else you can do that I'm done with this. What else can I do?
But this we've talked about this several times on the show. I don't think people who aren't in the industry, I don't think they realize that dishwashing has been a point of entry to this profession for some of the best chefs ever in the Thomas Keller was his first job.
I mean, you always, not that this is not meant in a negative way, you always start in the bottom, and you shouldn't, you know, you always strive to say like dishwashers aren't on the bottom and you have to respect every position, but in the general hierarchy of management, it's not the highest level that you can start at, and you have to respect every position, so that's where you start.
But isn't it also true that I'm fascinated with the whole dishwasher thing.
Sure.
I went a couple of years ago. I'm pretty friendly with Michael White. And they were getting ready to open his restaurant, Vaucluse, in Midtown Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be in the neighborhood. I said, hey, can I come take a look? And they were doing like staff tastings. And Rocky, who's like, I don't know what his title is, but he's director of operations for a couple of the restaurants now in Michael's group. And they had the front of house staff assembled in one of the dining rooms. And they were bringing food out from the kitchen. And at one point, there was a pause. And this was like, they were, you know, getting the team like synced up. Mm-hmm. And I remember Rocky got up and said, how many people in this room were a dishwasher at some point in your life? And these were a lot of front of house people. And I would say 90% of the hands went up.
Sure.
And he said, the dishwasher set the pace of every restaurant.
Yeah.
I want them treated with respect and on and on. And I've had many people say to me over the years, like, because I don't even think people realize this, that, you know, the plates that were on someone's table who were having their mains when you walked in are maybe coming to your table by the time you get to yours. Like,
sure.
Like they fall behind and the whole restaurant can go down.
Well, at Alinea, one of the most, there were two brilliant things I saw there when I worked there. And to this day, I don't know that I will ever appreciate an individual like idea more than I appreciate these two.
Okay.
One, all cooks at the time, because there was a waiting line to get in the kitchen, had to start as food runners.
Runners.
And so I was a food runner for my first like little over 2 months there.
Okay. Why was that?
Because you're waiting to get in the kitchen. And it does two things. One, it makes you as a cook appreciate the work the front of the house puts in.
Uh-huh.
Because like dialogue is a weird exception, but for the most part, without the service team, who's conveying your message as a chef?
100%.
You know, and who is your relationship to the diner?
Yeah.
And then also, it, from a chef's perspective, you're looking at a cook saying, go make double doing that. Do you still want to do this?
Yeah.
Was money the driving force or is it your passion and ambition?
Right.
And you'd lose a quarter to half of them because of the paycheck, because it was easier.
So they would say, no, I'm good here.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, for better or worse, fortunate that two people passed up the kitchen, so I got in when I did. Got Otherwise, it. There were two ahead of me still.
Right.
But the other thing is, I don't know how it is now, but at the time at Alinea and at Next when we opened, there was no dishwasher during the day.
Mm.
So if you burn something in a pot really badly,
yeah,
you're going to be back there cleaning it for 20 minutes. And you don't have time because you're too in the weeds. You don't have time to do your own. So you have to be a better, cleaner, more efficient cook.
Yeah.
Because you don't have time to waste washing, cleaning up the mess you made. And so, like, we don't have dishwasher dialogue during the day. I'm sure we won't at the next restaurant. Like,
yeah.
It makes you appreciate the work that they put in when you have to do it yourself. And all of a sudden you look at them. It's like a favor to you that they're there. You know, you have to respect them for that. And you can't, like, I remember the first day that I put a deli cup in the dish room that had a piece of blue tape on it still. And the chef threw it at me. He's like, take the tape off this. They're not your slaves. Like they don't work for you. Like they're here to do their job, not yours.
Yeah.
And it's just like once you're put in, I think every cook should, like if you have a new restaurant and you have cooks, start them as a runner or start them as a dishwasher. Make them respect all facets of what allow them to do the job they do. It's interesting because like in a restaurant right now, we're battling with this idea of expansion and teaching people how to become managers who've been managers. But it's like, it's kind of a double-edged sword to be a manager because you look at, I think of all the great chefs that I've worked for.
Yeah.
And the ones that I've respected the most are the ones who can step in and do your job with so much finesse after not having done it for so long. And you're like, man, that guy is awesome. Or, you know, whoever that person is, they just walked on here and they did exactly what I'm doing.
Yes.
Better while doing their job. And it just like inspires you to do something great. Like,
even
Matt right now, who's going to be running the new place, our dishwasher was really sick the last 2 weeks. And Matt's the extra guy now because we're phasing him out so he can do R&D.
Yeah.
So he's like, I'll just do dishes. And he just did dishes with the other dishwasher and was like teaching him about it and working with him. Our director of operations, Ann, she did the same thing. One of our dishwashers wanted a couple days off. And so she's like, I'll do dishes. I want to learn how the dish room works. But the trade-off is, as a manager, if you're, like, let's say you're the manager of a restaurant and your somm's out and you're going to be somm in the teens.
Yes.
Right? As a general manager of that restaurant, you're showing everyone that you can somm in the teens and you can work with them and you're in the trenches with them, but you can't lead from the trenches.
Right.
So what's going on in the 40s when you're in the somm in the teens, but you're the manager of the restaurant?
Right.
So it's like, it's a tricky thing to find that balance of, like, can I fight with you? And can I lead you to fight, right? Like, can you lead the battle and can you battle with them?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, the dishwashing thing. I mean, I wrote this book, Knives at Dawn, about the Boku's Door like 10 years ago. And there were certain things that really stuck with me. One was the whole handshake culture. I'd never seen that anywhere else. You know, like people shaking in. This must have been the case in Grant's places. It had to be.
Oh, like we'd all say hi to each other. There was
There wasn't the handshake thing? Mm-mm. Oh, wow. So, but you've seen this.
Like everyone shakes hands when they walk?
Yeah,
it's like almost, the chef walks in every day and shakes everyone's hand.
No, everyone shakes in and out. You come in, you make the rounds of the kitchen, and you shake everyone's hand.
I mean, I've never worked anywhere like that.
Yeah, they do it at Gavin. I know they do it at Spoon and Stable. Okay. It's almost like church.
Sure.
You know, peace be with you. And also, like, there's that kind of vibe to it.
Like someone wouldn't say hi to everyone when they came in, like, hey guys, you'd be like, oh, they're in a bad mood.
Yeah, no, Tim, you know, Hollingsworth, like, told me that if somebody didn't shake in or shake out when he was chef de cuisine there, he would call them the next morning and say, what's going on?
Yeah, like, it drives me nuts.
Because it was like a signal.
Someone doesn't say goodbye when they leave.
Yeah.
Like, just say goodbye.
No, at the French Laundry, I don't know if it's still like this, but it was shake in and shake out. The other thing that struck me, though, was this culture of cleaning and the dishes thing. There's a guy named Roland Henin, who was Thomas Keller's mentor, this older French guy. For years, he was with Delaware North Company. But he's the guy who Thomas kind of just met on the beach in Rhode Island in the 70s that took him from basically being like a burger flipper to like a guy who wanted to become the best chef in America. Right. I mean, literally, this is a true story. And Roland was the coach of the Bocuse d'Or that year. And if they were in the what they called the Bocuse house, which was two doors over from the laundry. You've been there, where Thomas's dad had lived before he died. And if there was a downtime, Roland, at the time, late 60s, early 70s, he would just like walk over to the sink and start cleaning dishes for people who were like in their 20s, you know? Just to be part of the team, do his part. Nobody was doing it. It needed doing. And I remember watching that and thinking, oh, my God.
You know, as a
that is some seriously ingrained culture. Like, that is it shouldn't be remarkable, but it was remarkable.
It's remarkable and frightening. Because, like, as a cook, you see your boss doing a job and you think to yourself, I let him down. Like, I failed them. I should have.
I mean, you should have jumped in.
Like, I should have been the one doing that, not them. And that kind of instills this culture of, like, in your head as a cook, you keep looking at the chef thinking, anytime they're doing something, I should be doing it so they don't have to. But then on the flip side, it's also inspiring to think, like, they're willing to do everything.
They'll do
I
it.
Should be, too.
Well, it's funny.
It's you know, again, the double-edged
It works sword both thing. Ways. But, you know, it's funny. Greg Backstrom, who I know you know from back in the early days
we
of Millennia.
We became chefs together.
So Greg, I was trailing. I don't need to get into why, but I was observing at Olmsted.
Sure.
And I can't remember if the guy had to leave, or I think they had to send him on an errand, maybe, the dishwasher. So all of a sudden, I look over and Greg's doing dishes for like 45 minutes before service. And when it was over, I said, why are you doing that? And he goes, well, the guy had to leave. So I had nothing. My work was done. You know, my prep work.
Someone else has to do it.
So I did it. Yeah.
A job needs to be done. Someone needs to do it.
But I think that I'm sure part of that was also showing his team, you know,
well,
I'm willing to do this, you know.
You always hate the person who's like, I don't want to do that job, so Garmage cook, you go do that, I'll do your salads.
Right.
You know, you want to show them that, like, you're not... I, as an individual, am willing to do anything that we need to do to make the restaurant successful.
Yes.
And you hope that everyone there is there for the same goal.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's not about proving it, it's just about believing in something.
Right.
Like, it's not like, I'm going to make a point by doing this. It's just what you need to do it. That's what you want to do.
So how do you get from the business thing to wanting to do what you do?
Well, so, I mean, I think in everything I've done, sports, school, whatever, you want to be the best at doing it. And so, I didn't really know what I wanted to do at all, but I liked cool things. And so my dad would come to Chicago every year for the National Restaurant Show. It's like a big trade show.
Sure.
And as a little kid, it was always like, Dad's on this like crazy trip, and he'd come back and he'd have these like bags of like cool cups that say Edward Don and have measurements on the side. It's a whole collection of them and like knickknacks that, you know, like a month later my stepmom would throw away kind of thing.
Right.
And so one year between my sophomore and junior year of college, he called me and was like, or email or something, and said, do you want to come to the restaurant show with me? Because I was north of Chicago.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything to do, so I said, sure, I'll go.
Yeah.
So picked me up, stayed in his hotel room with him, and we went to the restaurant show. And the whole thing was every year after the show, he'd go to a cool restaurant. And he took me with him. So we went to this restaurant called MK.
Mm.
And it was like Michael Cornick's place at the time. Chicago Magazine was doing the restaurant thing. It was like number 18 on their top 20 or something.
Style of food?
Think Spago minus pizza plus steak.
Okay.
Right? Like, had 90 seats, 100 seats.
I would love to see an IQ test from you. It's got that. That was quick. Can I say, by the way, I was looking for a moment to jump in. Forgive me. We're all having all this dishwasher talk. I'm sure I'll remember in the intro of the show to mention we're Hillary Sterling saved us today in this crazy day, let us borrow the office at Vic's. Right outside the door, we're behind the dish pit.
Yeah, they're just out there crushing. They're actually really quiet, relatively speaking.
Given what they're doing, yes, yeah, at the height of service, yes.
You know, there's not, like, nothing's being dropped.
Nope.
Nothing's,
you
know,
stacking plates. They're not slamming stuff. We're not hearing, like, the busser, what do you call them, the bins being, like, slammed down.
Yeah, and it's a busy restaurant upstairs.
Yes, yes. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, yeah. Okay, so that's MK.
Yeah, so we went there, and I just remember being swept away and thinking, like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. It's like it was in an old paint factory. It had, like, 30-foot ceilings with a skylight, like, big bow truss, like, exposed brick wall. It was stunning. As far as I was concerned, it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Now, this is interesting, because you're talking about space versus food.
So at the time, I was a vegetarian, and I got a vegetarian meal, so yeah. I don't remember what my entree was, but I remember getting these goat cheese and tomato raviolis that were incredible. Mm. I was like, this is the best thing I've ever had. And then we went to a couple other restaurants, went to some like Mambo Grill or something that was like cool for the minute, but only lasted a couple years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think we went to like Topola Bombo.
Okay.
And
Rick Bayless's restaurant.
Yeah. But MK just like swept me away. Yeah. I don't know why, but it was like the coolest thing. It was like something out of a movie. And then after the restaurant shows, my dad was bringing me back up to college to get my car because I left all my stuff up there. I was still in the dorms. He said, you know, I don't know if you're interested in doing this, but your grandma, we just found out she's really sick. She has pancreatic cancer. And she lived in northern lower Michigan.
Okay.
So like the tip of the middle finger. See, everyone knows, you know what I'm talking about when I say it. They're like right here.
No, I do, but that's another quick analogy.
Yeah.
Quick.
Michigan, you know, it's the mitten.
No, I got it.
She lived in a little town called Indian River, which is just outside Petoskey.
Yeah.
And he's like, would you be interested in staying with her for the summer and helping take care of her? Well, your uncle and I fly in and out every couple of weeks to kind of tie up the estate. And, you know, she did one stint of chemo and was like, I don't like the way I feel. I'm done. Right. She's like, I will do the best I can till I can.
I want to be home, and that's it.
Yep.
Yep.
And so I moved there in early June. She passed away right after the 4th of July. But while I was up there, we went to this little town called Bay Harbor, which is essentially like a private community right outside Petoskey.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just like bopping around looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in this restaurant called Latitude, and someone told me it was a really cool restaurant, and we'd just eaten there with my grandma like a couple days before, and I wanted to go back because they had a goat cheese pizza and I was so caught up on the goat cheese ravioli. And I was sitting at the bar and I was talking to the bartender. I was like, are you guys hiring? And the chef came out. I was like, yeah, we have a prep cook thing. Where have you worked? And I told him about Kathy's Kitchen, the diner I was at, and, you know, told my dad was a professor and all this stuff. And they're like, yeah, we need a prep cook. Hired me. And that summer made me want to be a chef. Like, it was this perfect balance. I mean, I had no clue what I was doing. Like, one day I came and I punched in and I just started trying to sharpen my knives. And the guy's like, you gotta get to work. Stop sharpening your knives. Like, go over there. They weren't my knives. It was like my dad's briefcase of like culinary school knives.
Right.
Like a tackle box or something?
No,
like
no. It was like a briefcase.
Oh, an actual briefcase?
Like, it was like Henkel for a minute gave out these briefcases.
Oh, I never saw those. I just remember I went to an abbreviated cooking program at what's now the ICC.
Okay.
And it was like a tackle box. You got a knife kit.
Yeah, they still do the tackle box.
And then like a
too.
Tackle box.
And this basically. Was like, I don't know, anyway. so, you know, the thing was that I also had to work lunch service. And so I fell in love with this idea of, this was like art and sports.
Yeah.
Like, that was a busy lunch place. And it was a cool restaurant that was really beautiful. And it was one of these things where, again, you're in love with that novelty of, this is something special that other people can't have. And I felt that way about that restaurant because it was like just elite enough and just special enough where you felt really cool telling people that that was the restaurant you worked at, because that was the best one in the area.
Yeah.
It was like that in Topawengo, where Stuart and I cannot remember his wife's name from State Bird Provisions.
The State Bird team? Yeah.
He was the head chef, Stuart Brioza. Yeah. He was the head chef there at the same time that I was at Latitude.
Yeah.
And I remember being at Latitude and the guys were like, yeah, this place Topawengo is the other best restaurant here. And this list came out. I was like, this is the best one. I had no idea, but I liked telling everyone it was the best.
Yeah.
So that's where I wanted to work. And so after that summer, they asked me if I wanted to come back the next summer. And then I just ended up like screwing around and doing nothing for the next summer. But I decided I wanted to be a chef. And so I was going to go to culinary school after
after college, and I couldn't afford it because if you have a bachelor's degree, you can't get financial aid for an associate degree. It's seen as a regression in your education. Okay. And so I didn't have 40 grand to put out for this culinary school degree. And, you know, knowing nothing about restaurants, I was like, I had a job. I can get another one.
Right.
So I applied everywhere in Chicago. Like, everywhere from, like, you know, I think I sent a resume to Trotters and to Maggiano's.
Wow.
Nobody hired me. And I sent, I staged at, like, Spring when Sean McClain was there, right? Okay. After he won his Beard Award.
Yeah.
I remember him because his girlfriend at the time I went to college with. And so Holly had, like, introduced me to Sean. I was like, well, you should do a day in the kitchen. He'll hire you. I remember at the end, I don't remember exactly how he said it, but he essentially said, maybe I should consider another career.
And, because why?
Oh, it was awful. I asked their cooks to help me, to teach me how to sharpen knives. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. I picked oxtail in the back corner for, like, a good 4 hours. Like,
just, how do you square what you just said with your sort of need for being kind of inconspicuous and perfect?
Well, that was...
So, like, to ask other people in a setting awesome. Like that to help you sharpen your knives.
Well, I was like, they were like, your knife's really dull. I was like, can you show me how to do it during staff meal so I can fix it? You know, you wanted to fix it. You wanted to solve the problem.
Got it. Okay.
And I had one knife that I, like, borrowed from someone.
So they told you to do something
else. And at the time,
like,
Spring was one of the best restaurants. Like, it just won a Beard Award.
Oh, it was hot. Talking about Spring. Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't... He was very polite about it. It wasn't like, dude, get a new career. It was just... A polite suggestion to a friend of his girlfriend's who tried out for a day. And, you know, I was super disheartened. And then I staged at True a few times. And True would take anyone for a stage because they just wanted people picking herbs.
Okay.
And so I was, like, super cocky about that. I was like, oh, I staged here, like, 5 times. I worked for free 5 times. Great.
Okay.
But it was still helping, like, understand what a kitchen was. And
sure.
So eventually I... sent a resume to MK and I got a call back and the chef de cuisine sat with me and talked. He's like, I didn't go to culinary school either. It's like, our French fry guy just quit. We'll hire you.
He's our,
like,
French fry guy?
Yeah, they had pommes frites with truffle aioli. It's like super high end. Came in a pint glass with paper. I was really good at the frites.
What's the trick?
I was terrible at the frites. My first few months, it was like you had to wrap them perfectly and put them in this cone.
But were they home? Were they actually
house
made?
Yeah, start to finish house
made.
You
did like two fries?
Yeah.
You double fried it?
It was
the cold fry and the hot fry. Yeah.
And, but you know, the problem is when you use fresh potatoes, there's different sugar contents in different seasons.
Yeah,
so like some day they turn brown at 300 degrees and some days they don't get any color at 400.
Right.
I don't know why. I just was trying to make them happen. But anyway, so he offered me a job. He said, we'll give you a 2-week trial. And either you make it or you don't, and we'll just fire you. I was like, okay. So I came in, I staged, they hired me, and I was a disaster for like 3-4 months. One day he just decided that he was going to send the meat. The chef at the time was going through a lot of personal issues.
Okay.
So he was like a bit disassociated at times, a bit more committed, a bit intoxicated.
Yeah.
You know, there was like a lot going on.
Yeah.
And either he really liked me or really didn't. Because he would just put me in these situations that were incredibly challenging. Like one day he just sent the meat cook home. And I made the french fries next to the meat cook.
Okay.
And he used to call me son. He'd be like, son, you're cooking the meat tonight. I never cooked a piece of meat in my life.
Oh my God.
And the...
Not just for service, like at all?
No, never, nothing.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure I'd burn things on a grill, like hot dogs. But
yeah,
I couldn't hit medium rare if my life depended on it. And there was a guy... Amador Acosta, who was Michael White's, like,
Yes, I forgot this. I knew you guys were connected. Yeah.
Yeah, so Amador was a cook at MK.
Yeah.
And he was walking, he was kind of like walking around, floating, and Steven was like, Amador, go help, or Aga, they called him Aga. He's like, go help him. So Aga worked with me that night. And then maybe like 2 weeks later, he did the same thing again.
Yeah.
And the... exec Sue, Eric Williams, was walking out the back door, and he was like running the mornings at the time, and he looked at me and he's like, I'd never seen anyone turn white with so much fear. And so he came in and he was the one who was like, I'm not going to do this for you, but I'm going to stand next to you and make sure that you don't fail. And he made french fries all night, and he wouldn't say, yes, I think that's okay, that's medium rare, you're fine. He would say, well, what do you think and why do you think that? And fortunately, because he was there, he was like protecting me from getting yelled at, because Eric wasn't getting yelled at by Steven.
Right.
And I think in that moment I learned that
taking an extra 30 seconds will add to, will save you 2 minutes of time. To where Eric would say, I know he says he needs this now, but if we stop and think about what it is and how we can accomplish it,
yeah,
then you'll give it to him once, not twice. And we'll save time. And so Eric was the one who basically saved me from quitting that restaurant.
Okay.
And essentially, whether this is actually the case or not, in retrospect, he's probably the one who kept me in the restaurant industry.
Wow.
So, because like at that point, I was like, you know, I was 22.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have an adult man yelling at you from behind the line, throwing like a lamb chop at your hat, yeah, knocking it off your head. Yeah. And, you know, there's this other guy, and they're both people that you look up to, and all you're doing is failing them and failing yourself. And I was like, I'm done with this. Like, I was never meant to do this. And Eric made me stay and worked with me that night, and everything changed. I was like, that's
amazing.
It. Yeah.
So what did you have any sense when you start down this path, like what kind of chef you thought, like what kind of chef you thought you'd become, what kind of food you thought you might be doing? I don't mean dishes. I just mean like stylistically, what genre really cool. you would fit into. Really cool.
Really cool. Like we would have plating competitions at MK on the line, and it was like, I remember the day I learned how to do a spoon drag. I remember the day that we took the tuna dish and we saw who could plate it better. And all my food started getting smaller and prettier. And
I'm really interested to hear how you and Grant connect because he talks like this.
Well, so I...
He talks about like when he was a kid in the, what is it, the slot cars?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard him? I moderated a panel once where he gave...
He worked at the St. Clair
Diner. This used to be like his thing where you talk about like, I want to just have the fastest car.
Yeah.
You know,
whatever it is, you want to be the best, or you have to have the best, or you, even if it's not the best, it has to be the thing that no one else can have.
That people notice, the head turner.
Yeah, like
yeah,
we that might be the best, and we can all buy the best, but that's the thing that nobody has.
Right,
and that's the one that I want.
When were you able to first put words to that? Do you know?
Probably right now. I don't know. No one's ever asked me the question to get that answer.
Okay. I have to ask you one other thing before we move past this moment. It seems to me like you going down the... It's I don't know. At least as I'm hearing you, it doesn't all... It feels like the restaurant thing was like this perfect kind of... Like a funnel, almost, of all these contradictory things, right? Sure. Like you didn't love school, but you did good at it. You know, you were attracted to art, but you go to business school. You know, like you kind of once in a while kind of break the rules a little and crawl through some, go under a fence to go see some graffiti, right?
Sure. And I mean,
you pour all those into a funnel, and like one place that funnel might empty into is a kitchen.
Yeah.
Well, right? It's all that stuff. It's a little forbidden.
Probably the thing my dad discouraged me the most from.
Right. There you go. Like, but that's what I mean.
He was mad at the way I picked college. He was frustrated with the fact that I was wasting a degree to the point where even as I started cooking, it was, you know, you could have gone to culinary school for free if this is what you were going to do.
Right.
Like, you wasted 4 years here and all this money, you could have gone to culinary school for free. And, you know, in retrospect, part of it, I don't know if he would ever say it or admit it, but, you know, he always wanted to be a chef and talks about, like, when he worked at the country club and we did this and then got into teaching and, you know, still loved cooking, but never went that path.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think as I did it, there were moments where he was, this comes more from my mom, like my dad's his own thing. He'll never talk about this stuff.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, I think one thing she would bring up is that I'm always doing what he talked about wanting to do.
Wow.
That's
heavy.
And yeah, so like, you know, he never ate at MK when I worked there. He never ate at True when I worked there. He never ate at Linea when I worked there. The first time I cooked for him was at Next during Friends and Family during the Paris menu.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I walked him through Alinea once when it was closed for a holiday break. And that was like 3 months before I left. 6 months before I left, somewhere in there. Before I left Alinea to go to Next. So that was like late 2010.
Well, first of all, we have to get you to Alinea.
Yeah.
So how'd you get there?
Okay, so, you know, part of the thing with MK was that I applied to... I basically took Chicago Magazine and applied to the 20 best restaurants in Chicago.
Okay.
And among everything else, like even neighborhood bars. And when I was at MK, you know, my first 3 months were a disaster.
Yeah.
My next 3 months, I kind of figured it out.
Yeah.
At 1 year, I thought I was like king of the world.
Yeah.
At a year and a half, they had offered me sous chef, junior sous chef, which is sous chef. I don't know. And at that point, I kind of had this moment of like deer in headlights where I thought, you know, if you can't be a sous chef anywhere, you shouldn't just be one somewhere. And just because I can climb this ladder doesn't mean I'm ready to climb every other ladder.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, I kind of had a really challenging moment with the chef de cuisine at the time, different one than the one that hired me, where he and I did an event, and, you know, there were like a couple drinks at the event, and then he was like, let's go to this wine bar afterwards. And like a few people from our staff and like some people in the industry were at this wine bar. And he ordered a few bottles of wine and was like getting fairly drunk. And at some point I was talking to the somm of the wine bar and I said, he's like, what do you want to drink? And I said, I don't know anything about wine. I don't care what I drink. Just tell me what it is. Like, tell me what and why. And the chef at the time looked at me and goes, what does it matter? You're never going to understand it anyway. And, you know, I'm sure he meant in a harmless way of like, he's very wine savvy and I'm not, or maybe it's over. However he meant it, it was irrelevant, because at that moment I realized I had nothing more to learn from him. And if I had nothing more to learn from him, why was I spending my time with him?
Right.
So about a week later, he asked if I wanted to be a sous chef. And that week I had applied to True and Trotter, because that was 2005 and it was the year that it was Trotter versus True. And the Tribune did this 10-point article of like which restaurant's better, and True came out 1 point ahead.
Oof.
So, which, you know,
I would have loved to have been at Trotter's house for that one.
Yeah. And, you know, True had a very glorious moment where I would agree that it had possibly more amenities or had the means to be a better restaurant in that flash of the pan.
Yeah.
But Trotter's is the American guest, like fine dining world would not be what it is without restaurants like Trotter or without chefs like Trotter.
I mean, the way people talk, even people not of that generation talk about even just what they got from the books, people who had never been there, people who never made the pilgrimage, it's pretty crazy.
People who love him and people who hate him still acknowledge him.
Yes.
And I think that's an important thing. Like, for the people, like, even, you know, Ackett's talking about how terrible his 3 months were.
Yeah.
The fact is he has to acknowledge that that influenced him to do something. He would not have been at French Laundry if he had not worked for Trotter.
Yes.
And so he would not have had Alinea.
Yes.
You know, and so I applied to both because I had to be at one of those two because that was the best in the city.
Yeah.
And I got a job at True. So in the meeting where I was offered or asked to be a sous chef, I quit. Told him I was going to True. Never told him why. The exec Sue, Eric, the one who worked with me, knew the whole story.
Yeah.
And he was very supportive. So I went to True. And that was like probably the most aggressive, intense, immersive, like, crash course in how to cook properly. Where, like, the chef de cuisine was from Ducasse. He was incredibly talented. He liked me, I guess, because every 6 weeks he just moved me from a new station to the next station. And for my first week, he would just cook next to me. So he just, you're going to make sauces, I'm going to make them with you. You're going to butcher, I'm going to teach you how to butcher. And I think my second 6 weeks there, I had to do a muse. So every day you had to come up with like 8 new bites. And I called the chef from MK in a panic. And he's like, stop. I think the words out of his mouth were literally, stop being a bitch. And I was like, what? I have to. He's like, it's just food. Just put it on the plate. It'll be fine. They're not going to let you. They're not going to let their restaurant fail because you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
And they're not going to fire you because they don't want to replace you. So you're fine. And he was right. So I did it. And I spent a year at True, and after working all the stations, I was torn out, and Joel had asked me if I was interested in becoming a sous chef there, and then we had some very candid conversations about his time at Ducasse and what that did for him and what I really wanted, and he's like, honestly, I'm going to be leaving.
Yeah.
This isn't the right restaurant for you to continue to grow in.
Yeah.
And he helped me set up stages at French Laundry and Robichon.
Yeah.
So I was like emailing Corey Lee. But prior to leaving MK, I'd applied at Alinea as well.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear back. And before MK, I'd applied at Trio. I never heard back, which was the timing that Ackett's was leaving there anyway.
We should say that was where, overall, we should say Corey was the first chef de cuisine that the French Laundry ever had.
Yeah.
And when Keller started to sort of transition to the role he plays now. And Grant, was it the chef at Trio before Alinea happened.
Yeah. Yeah. He went from Laundry to Trio to Alinea.
Yeah. And Trio in Chicago. Yeah.
You know, so I'd applied with him a couple times and never heard back for very obvious reasons of my resume was garbage.
Okay.
And you know, I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I wouldn't have hired myself.
Yeah.
And so one night I worked with this girl at True named Kim Floresca, who was the CDC at Meadowood for a little bit.
Uh-huh.
She was at Per Se and Mugri. So she's been everywhere. She was one of the most badass chefs I've ever worked with on the line. Like, what she could do and look so elegant and composed.
Yeah.
Like, to this day, I wish I could work like her.
Yeah.
Like, the way I remember her doing that. So her boyfriend was a guy named Dan who worked at Alinea. And, like, for Valentine's Day, you know, he used to bring prep home from Alinea and she would help him after work.
Okay.
So he'd have enough done. And so for Valentine's Day, we did like a box of dice. They used to have to dice these sugar cubes at Alinea. And so you'd take the block of sugar cube and you'd dice it into smaller cubes, which is a disaster. Like, try it one day. It's terrible. So Kim and
Talk about needing to have your knife sharpened.
Well, you'd have to like do this little saw and chip method so it cracks along the scored line. So one day, Kim and I did a whole deli cup of them, which was enough for him for a week, so that they could spend the evening together after work and cook dinner and watch a movie.
That's such a great detail. Yeah.
So when she's like, Dan and I are leaving, you should send a resume and apply for his job. Like, there's going to be an opening. And so we were at a bar one night, like really late. And I was, you know, typical Saturday night after work at 5 a.m, we're all hammered. And I was like, I'm going to send a Hail Mary resume to Alinea, knowing all in well that I was like, had these stages lined up in a few weeks. And I got a call back the next morning, asked me to come in for a tryout. I went in, I tried out, I got a job that night.
What was the tryout?
It was a stage. It was just spending
a
day in the
standard.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Normally they required a week. I said that I couldn't give them a week. I could give them a Sunday because that's the only day we were closed at True. And it was Atkins on the phone. He sounded like a 10-year-old. And I was like probably still half in the bag when I answered the phone at 10 a.m. because I probably sent the email at like 6. And I set up a tryout, and I went, and I staged for the day, and they offered me a job that night.
Yeah.
So I went in the next Tuesday to True, and I quit. Told Joel I got the job there, and he's like, that's awesome. Put in by 2 weeks, took a week vacation, started Alinea.
This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation. Tucked in a 640-square-foot shipping container space in the heart of Denver's Rhino neighborhood, Cart Driver is the perfect place to stop in for an Italian-style spritz, Prosecco on tap, and a wide variety of tinned fish. Open for lunch, dinner, community hour, and late nights 7 days a week, Cart Driver is here for you with fresh, domestically sourced ingredients, and above all, hospitality. Learn more at cart-driver.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dave Arnold, and I'm the host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. Every week, I answer listeners' questions on the latest innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients in the food world. Have a question about hot rotting your oven to make great pizza? Give us a call. Hydrocolloid, sous vide, liquid nitrogen? No problem. You can find Cooking Issues wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. Going to get you right back to the rest of our interview with Chef Dave Barron in just a moment. Kevin, can I just ask, do you subscribe to podcasts?
I do.
That's the best way, right?
Yeah.
It's free.
It's free. Absolutely.
And they just show up in your queue.
It's easy.
It's easy.
There's
so
a
this
lot of people
is,
who still don't understand how the podcast works.
There's a lot of people who don't know that there's a podcast app on your phone, on all phones. Usually it's a purple microphone icon. And once you open it, it's more or less, it's very intuitive the way most things are on a smartphone. And it's like using your music app. It's very simple.
Yeah, and you don't have to search for something specifically. You can go to the browse button and you can look at the top charts.
Yes.
And they have different genres
in
there.
Or you can search by, or you could search for chefs.
Or you can search Andrew Talks to Chefs.
You could do that. Hit subscribe and it'll just show up every week. And that's the best way for you guys to keep up with the show. If you are a listener on Apple's podcast store, as always, the only thing we ask of our listeners ever is to throw us a rating or review. It does help people find the show. It's not just ego. We'd really appreciate that. And if you'd like to keep up with us any other way, we highly recommend doing that on Instagram. Our handle is at Chef Podcast. podcast. Very easy to remember.
I'm pretty stingy with my stars, and I still gave you 5 stars.
Did you review me?
I did, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Did you write me a review?
No.
No. Well, your time's valuable.
No, I did. I had no time for that. I was proud of myself that I went in and did this.
If you had a podcast, I would have written you a review. I'm just saying. But that's okay.
But don't... I might be busier than
yes, you. That's entirely possible. Okay. With that, I'm going to return you now to the rest of our interview with Chef Dave Barron. I hope you enjoy it.
What was your initial rapport with Grant like?
I don't think I talked to him. He was quiet, and he stood very focused at his cutting board, and okay. Nobody talked to him.
Who did you talk? Like, who was the ranking kitchen person that you talked to?
Curtis.
Okay.
Curtis. I was a food runner when I started.
It was Curtis Duffy.
Yeah, Curtis Duffy.
Yeah.
I was a food runner, so I almost didn't take the job when I found out I had to run food. And I remember sitting with my girlfriend at the time at Boca, which is a restaurant next door, talking to...
Oh, that's Kevin's...
Kevin Bam.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I was actually talking to Kevin at either Boca or Landmark with my girlfriend at the time and saying, why would I quit this great career path that I'm on to go be a food runner there?
Yeah.
And Kevin was just like, it would be a mistake not to do that. And I did it. And I ran food. And Curtis was super nice, and I didn't talk to anyone else.
Okay.
I really liked Joe Catterson a lot, and I got along with the front of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had that mentality of, like, I'm going to be the best runner. So I remember taking a kitchen ticket day one and putting it in my pocket. And, you know, you had to learn how to describe the dishes. And Atkins would randomly test the front of the house, and he'd be like, what's the radish dish? What's the crab dish? Give me your spiel on the hot potato.
Was this during lineup, or he would pull this people off the floor and ask them?
No, this was
like,
during the prep day. Or
okay, during the day.
First meeting. Yeah, the service meeting.
Got it.
If you didn't know, he'd send you home.
Yep.
You know, and there was like one day I remember him, he did to like 6 people, and Joe Catterson was like, if you send another person home, we're not going to be able to do service. And he looked at Joe and he said, describe the radish dish to me. And Joe described it, and then he said, okay, we're done. And he went downstairs. And like...
Oh,
that was it.
God.
Like, he was ready to send his general manager home if he couldn't describe it. Like,
that is so great. That is so great.
Yeah, so I ran food, and I think he appreciated the fact that I ran food like a cook, not like, you know, like it's how you proved yourself. You want to be in the kitchen, you prove yourself.
Yeah.
And I was pretty fortunate that, you know, it worked out, and he started liking me, and when runners were cut first, I started being one of the last ones cut. And then Ryan Bartlow, who was, I think he's like one of the chefs at Frankie's now, or the head chef at Frankie's here.
Okay, here.
He cut his hand on the slicer, and, you know, it was bad, and he like missed 2 days, and then he called and quit and didn't come back. And on a Saturday, he looked at me and said, tomorrow you're in the kitchen if you want it. And the next day I showed up in Chef White's at 11:30 instead of 2. I was in the kitchen on his station with no training, and Curtis helped me prep it. And, you know, I knew all the food because I'd been running food.
Yeah.
So I knew what the dishes looked like. I just didn't know how to make anything.
Yeah.
And Curtis kind of prepped my station with me for a couple of days, and that was it.
What was the whole cult? I mean, that to me, you know, the early days of that restaurant, that's like one of those, you know, moments in time, you know, where there was, I mean, there was like an all-star crew at that restaurant.
That place was crazy.
It's crazy.
Like, We were just talking about this earlier today. How,
who was it? Stu Pack was the pastry chef.
Well, so like as a cook, you talk about other restaurants. Like there's that whole story of, you know, Thomas and Danielle and Colicchio and Boulay and all
and
these
Alfred,
guys working together.
Yeah, Altopolo. Yeah,
all working together.
Alfred Portale. Yep.
And you know, we'd talk about like, could you imagine ever being on a line like that? Well, in retrospect, I look at the line that I was on at
Linnea, this is what I'm saying.
And Duffy was there.
Yep.
Greg Backstrom.
Yes, of Olmsted.
David Posey, who has Elska in Chicago. I know I'm going to
say Stu Pack was pastry.
Stu Pack and Jordan Kahn.
Yep, who now has Vespertine in L.A.
I'm forgetting people.
But this is one of those all-star kitchens. This is one of those moments in time. This is like the opening. This is like the people who worked for Waxman back at Jams. This is like the people who worked at Gramercy Tavern. I was talking to Claudia Fleming today. I don't think I'll air the episodes on the same day. But the opening crew at Gramercy Tavern, Marco Canora running the grill, and Claudia Fleming in her first pastry job, and Colicchio in the kitchen.
And this was like
crazy.
1 year in. And it, oh, yes. John Shields.
John Shields.
Smith
sure.
was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just remember working with all these guys, and there was no morning prep team. We thought the kitchen was huge, and there were, I think, including all managers, Atkins, everyone, 12 people.
Yeah.
And now I think there's like 30, you know, and a prep team and an herb guy. And
yeah.
So it was insane, you know, to look back in retrospect and think like we were just trying to survive every day. You know, Chicago, that was a really special time for the city because that's really when like the dining scene was truly coming to fruition there.
And, yep.
You know, the ego of the Chicago restaurants was like, we are better than New York and we're proving it. And, you know, whatever restaurant city's better, like, how do you even judge if a restaurant city's better? Like, there's more for the size? I don't know. But to you me, had a very enthusiastic and ambitious dining scene, and you had diners who were equally as excited. And so there was a lot of pride in those restaurants because you genuinely thought that, like, I mean, I remember when we picked up the Aquavit book at True, and then we picked up the French Laundry book at True, and we were all like, look at these things. And then all of a sudden, you'd get like all these crazy new plates and these new things.
Yeah.
And then you get to Alinea and all of a sudden you're not talking about any other restaurant.
Right.
You just didn't. Like, you didn't have time and you didn't care. It was just like, this is what we do.
Yes.
And that's all we do.
Yeah.
And there was never, no one ever walked in the kitchen and was like, oh, did you hear about the, it just didn't happen.
Well, in those...
You worked and that was your restaurant. That was
I mean,
it.
That was, it still is one of them. But like at that time, that was, you know, there's always like, you know, the heat always moves around, right?
Yep.
Like at that time, for that level of dining in this country, and in some ways internationally, that that restaurant was it for a year, good year or two. Like it had that place.
I remember when in 2006 we were all staying in the kitchen and we all got called together for an announcement, and Ackett's held up the Gourmet magazine, and it was Ruth's list of the top 100 in the country, and Alinea was number one.
Yeah.
And it was a year and 4 months old.
Yeah.
And he's like, we did it. And a restaurant, in retrospect now, still even understanding its identity, you know, and there have been better menus since the menu that came out at that time, right?
Okay,
in that, the tenure of that restaurant.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I would agree that there was not a better restaurant. Not because, like, French Laundry wasn't better, but because that restaurant was so hungry. And had so much talent. And
well,
everyone there was like, no one's going to beat us.
The term I always use is moving the ball forward.
Yeah.
Right? So the French Laundry by then had sort of solidified into what it was. And I haven't eaten there in a couple of years, but probably what it is now. You know, and it kind of found what it was and settled into that. That's what most restaurants eventually will do.
Sure.
Alinea was moving the ball forward. It was that level. I mean, Grant obviously had worked for Keller. It was that level of sort of... I say this on the show. One day I'm going to get a phone call from that 703 or whatever it is phone number. You know, Thomas always says, you know, there's no such thing as perfection, which I just think is hilarious. To me, it's hilarious because I don't think there's a bigger perfectionist on planet Earth. But, you know, Grant kind of took that and applied it to this very forward-looking, put it in a whole new, you know, it's like he transplanted that element into a very forward-looking thing, right? And so that's what made it exciting. You know, it was the next evolution of that level of that standard.
And
right?
In that time, we all believed that we were doing things that had never been done before.
Well, you were.
You know.
Don't you think? I mean,
yeah,
I know cooks hate the term, like, they don't like to say they invented something, but a restaurant like that, as Ferran did in Spain.
It changed things.
But there were techniques and dishes that you guys did that
hadn't
been done. It wasn't just, you know, a lot of people, I think, with genuine humility will say, like, you don't really invent new dishes. You just do a spin on.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I think Grant's very much on this, you know, he sort of to me is like this. You take the spirit of someone like Thomas and you take kind of what Ferran did.
Well, he found a new way to make diners imagine.
Yes, but I think it's in that. You know, it took those two tracks, kind of.
Yeah.
And in a way, you kind of became the next step of both of them.
Yeah, for sure.
And does that make sense?
Yeah. And, you know, it's...
Because it was fine dining.
It
was
the
service standards of, like, any restaurant you'd... Anywhere.
Yeah.
But it was also very kind of futuristic. Yes, and it was also... Right, there was a sense of humor. There was a sense of adventure. There was a sense of science. There was a sense of, I'm going to show you.
I mean,
to your point before, we're going to show you some shit you've never seen before.
Yeah. I remember the first time I ate there, before I worked there, and I was sitting in the upstairs back dining room, and my girlfriend had taken me from there for my birthday. Between the time I tried out and started working there, I think. Maybe it was just before. I might have like the order mixed up, but we were fighting, and she still took me there. And
I remember sitting in this silent room at an awkward moment when there was no one else in there, and there wasn't music at the time. I didn't know anyone.
Yeah.
And the server came up and poured water and just said, this is our 2003 vintage, and just walked away, and we both started cracking up. I was like,
that's hilarious.
Yeah. That's someone who read a moment, and this isn't a dig on True, but when I was at True, they were designed to not have personality. Right? It was very much like, no, we serve this way, we clear this way. Yeah. It was choreographed service. And so that was the first moment where I was like, it can make you feel a certain way. That's okay to feel that way. Right? You don't have to worry about if you can touch something. You know, you can laugh a little bit. They can crack a joke. Yeah, we can be friends.
This, to me, is one of the great dividing lines of front of house philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are, I don't want to name names. Everyone will probably know who I'm talking about, including you. I think there are companies where the culture is such that people are almost trained at the point of robotics.
Sure, 100%.
I hate that.
I do too.
And then there are places where people hire people they really like. They know people are smart. The earliest example for me of this that I personally experienced was when Sean Terrell, you know, every server in that place was there. They were elegant. They knew what they were doing. They did their job with great professionalism. Each of them was had their own personality.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, people remember some of those people.
Yeah.
And you see them around New York still, and people, diners remember them, knew their names, you know. There was a guy named Edward there who had this little wispy beard, like a little wispy thing on his chin,
sure.
And these big glasses, and he's a photographer in his free time. And I can't tell you how many people recognize him to this day when he, you know, in other restaurants. That thing, that element where people have the freedom, you know, okay, you're going to get your job. People who understand the lane they need to be in, mm-hmm. and if they can stay in that lane, they can be themselves within that lane.
Sure.
I think that is a great stylistic dividing line in restaurants.
Well, and I think also, too, when you allow personalities to come forward, it shows a different level of confidence in a restaurant.
Yeah.
It shows that we're willing to do what we do because we know we're good enough to allow you to do what you want to do.
As a yeah. staff member.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And, like, I mean, the guy who served us is a guy named Jason. Jason Kunzer, and he was a back waiter.
Yeah.
He poured that water, and he changed my perspective on a restaurant.
Yes.
Like, in that very moment, and, like, what was probably the death of my meal wasn't the death of my meal.
Right.
Because he saved the entire evening
yeah.
by cracking one joke, knowing the exact moment and just how much to give.
So, for me, the moment was the opposite moment, the one where I realized how much I hate the other style,
mm-hmm.
was I went to a restaurant years ago. I'd just done a book with a chef. We were going to have dinner with our editor, and we walk in, and the reservation was in the chef's name, and we walk in, and the woman at the podium, we say, so the editor was arriving separately. So we walk in, we give the name, and they say, and this was at the time anyway, it was very against New York's standard operating procedure because they always want to still really wait till your party's complete. Mm-hmm. With good reason. I think customers who don't understand that really don't get what
sure.
is happening on the restaurateur side of the equation. But very graciously, she said, would you like to go ahead and sit down? And I said, oh, if that works for you, that would be great. And this is the part where they lost me. She leans forward and says, well, what works for you, sir? And I just felt like I was having my nose rubbed in how accommodating they were.
Sure.
It just seems silly. Like, obviously, there's no one who would not want to be sat.
Yeah. It's like I hate the whole, like, you know, we don't normally do that. But I, you know, I guess we can make it. It's just like, you either do it or you don't.
Do
like,
it. Be gracious. Right. Be gracious.
Yeah.
Yes. That was the other side of it. But yeah, no, it's... Anyway, I've only been to Alinea once, but it was an incredible experience. Incredible.
Yeah. It was there was a lot of, I mean, I'm sure there still is, but I usually just think of it in my time there. There's a lot of magic in that building.
Yeah. So you eventually, I'm correct, right? You eventually rose to chef de cuisine there.
Yeah. So I was food runner and then cook through July of 2007.
Uh-huh.
And then in the same all-staff meeting, so Atkinson and I went to Spain in May
yeah.
for like 2 weeks, came back, and I think it was the first week of July, he announced to the staff over speakerphone that Curtis Duffy was leaving, Greg Backstrom, myself, and Nathan Klingbeil were becoming sous chefs, Jeff Pikus was going to be the new chef de cuisine, we had two new employees, and he had tongue cancer.
Oof.
And that was all over speakerphone while he was at Sloan Kettering while we sat in the downstairs dining room.
Wow.
And that was the conversation of the evolution of that restaurant. Like,
what do you mean?
This is
that?
The next wave. Like, John Peters had left. Curtis had left. This was our first next chef de cuisine. This is the next level of management. And by the way, I'm sick, but it's going to be okay.
That was the tone he delivered it in.
Yeah. And it was like this very like weird, like these are bullet points. And we tried to do a video conference in the upstairs dining room, but you couldn't see the computer and it wasn't connecting. And the speakerphone was downstairs. So we all piled in this little dining room and closed the curtain so you could hear it really well. And that was it. And then a month later, Curtis had his last day. Three other cooks had their last day. I think the kitchen was like maybe 10 people.
Wow.
And then about a month later was when he wasn't able to come in anymore, around October. In like October, November, December maybe, we really didn't see him. And then the cancer was gone and he started coming back.
Incredible. You know, I didn't know Grant back in those days. I've seen photos, though. Like, people who only know Grant in his, like, world-famous mode.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of skinny. But he was, like, a stocky guy. Wasn't he a weightlifter?
He and Mark Hopper used to, I think it was Hopper, would come into French Laundry at, like, 7, 8 in the morning, do their thing, go to the gym, come back, have their, like, egg white omelet, continue working. Yeah, he was a beast. I mean, even when we went to Spain and he wasn't working out, I think he was still like 170. And he was only like 5'9", maybe. And when we saw him after we hadn't seen him for a month or so, he was like 115 pounds.
Yeah, I know people were like stunned by that.
Like, we didn't recognize him when he came in the back door. He had a baseball hat on and no hair anywhere. And,
oh, man.
Really pale. And I mean, he looked like a skeleton.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
So how did next? We got to talk. We got to get to dialogue, but and to California. But next was such a unique. For people who don't know, was it quarterly?
Three times a year.
Three times
it was
a year.
Supposed
it changed
to be quarterly, and we realized the workload and decided to make it three times a year.
Okay. Slacker.
Yeah. So I became CDC of Alinea after Pikus left in like October of 2008, and then. I think somewhere in like 2010, Ackett sat me down. He was like, I understand how chefs evolve and how you're probably thinking of doing your own thing. And we'd love to talk to you about that if you have different ideas and so on and so forth. And this was like blindsided me because all I could think was, this is all I've ever wanted to do. Like, this is the best restaurant in the country. And, you know, I'm the chef de cuisine of it. And, you know, your ego's through the roof.
Yeah.
My ego, not it. But like, these are all things that you say to yourself when you're in a situation. And so I kind of blew it off, and then I was like, I don't even have a style. I don't even know what I cook. Like, this is all I've ever wanted to cook. And and so a few months later, like, Nick and Chef start talking to me. And
this is Nick Kokonis, his partner, business partner, and founder of Talk. Yeah.
Yeah. So they, you know, when Ackett's was sick, when he was talking to Nick, he made him like a random like duck breast and morel thing. And it was like classic French. And Nick was like, why don't we do a bistro? And he's like, well, we'd get bored. Then he did it again with a pasta dish. He's like, why don't we do an Italian place? And he's like, the cooks would get bored. And so fast forward after everyone's healthy and everything's good. And he's like, Nick is, you know, on the side coming up with this idea for selling tickets and came up with this idea. Well, what if we took all these things that we were good at and just did them, showed that we were the best at doing all of them? So like every, you know, few months when we're bored, we just change. And then we get bored again and we change again. And that, over some G-Chat conversations and a couple of conversations in person, became the idea for Next.
Uh-huh.
And simultaneously, the idea for what became Talk. And so Next and the ticket system were created together.
Yeah.
As kind of that testing ground, but also as a way to show why tickets could be used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you're changing all the time, it's like theater. So you buy tickets to it.
It's a limited engagement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Runs, it's, you know, that's it. It's special. It's unique. Get it while you can.
Yeah.
And I did not want to do it. Like, the first menu was supposed to be Paris Bistro. I think it was like 1910 Bistro because the Seine flooded in 1909 and the start of Bistro was 10. And my first thought was like, you know, we were on the cusp of the Michelin stars and we had just gotten 7 in the world. And I was the chef de cuisine. I'm like, why would I leave here to go to a bistro? I have no interest. Yeah. Because, you know, at that moment, I wasn't realizing how special it could be. I was thinking like, why would I step down to do something anyone else can do? This is something special.
Right.
And
well, I go back to this earlier conversation, you know, about the failing thing. It's like, you know, you're the chef de cuisine of number 7 restaurant in the world, and that restaurant's on a clear path, right?
Yeah.
You're going to, then you're going to go to a place where every 3-4 months you're going to tear it up.
Yeah,
and put yourself out there again.
You know, I had no interest in making bistro food.
Yeah,
none.
Yeah,
and, which is ironic now. And so, eventually, you know, as we were talking about it, we realized in talking to Ackett's, we needed to make it something more special, and that's when the idea of the Escoffier menu came in. Because we kept talking about how these current French chefs would reference Escoffier, but no one really knew what Escoffier's food was. And it gave it an opportunity to be French food that no one was touching, and tasting menu format, and elevated, which were all the things that I wanted. And so we talked again, and eventually I agreed to doing next, and finished at Alinea in July of 2011, or yeah. January in 2011,
yeah.
And started there. We opened in April.
Yeah. It's amazing. So what were some of the first... Go ahead. What were some of the first ones? You did that one.
I did 15 of them. So Paris 1906, Tour of Thailand, Childhood, El Bulli.
El Bulli, awesome. That's the one I came... I flew in for one night to have that dinner. Yeah. Amador Acosta.
That was the only time I've ever cooked someone else's food where I was so excited to do it. Because, one, we got to craft a menu that they had never served.
Yeah.
Which was a retrospective on one course from every year they'd ever done. So we were showing the history of the restaurant and the evolution of it.
And this was after it closed.
This is after it closed. It opened right with their 6-month closure, which is when their museum exhibit in Barcelona opened.
Yeah.
And so we donated one table to charity. We did something else for something. And we did a single seating. And I got to learn the history of El Bulli and what they did and why it was special. And it totally changed my perspective on menu writing, on the importance of courses, on how you document things. Like, their entire thought process changed the way I thought about things.
I mean, I remember after eating there. So I flew in with a group. It was Michael White and a bunch of his cooks and chefs. You guys put us at the chef's table, mm-hmm. or the whatever you call that in the back. I don't know what you guys called it. Kitchen table. Yeah. But separated by a pane of glass.
In the fishbowl.
You're not in the kitchen. And I remember just like the commitment to what you guys were doing blew my mind.
I mean,
so first of all, you did the dishes as they were. Correct me on any of this because I'm just going from my memory of a night where I had a lot of alcohol and food. But you did the dishes as they were in the year that they were first done. So if they had evolved over the years, you didn't do the current version.
Correct.
You did the original one. There was one dish that was in one of the books. And I think it was a seafood dish, and I think in the way it was shot in the book, it had it was shot like it was shot like with the rocks and water under it. And you guys had created this little like pouch almost.
We did like a bag of like,
with rocks and water, and like that, and the food was served on top of that. So you recreated the photo effect.
Yeah,
that was pretty amazing. I mean, it was that level of detail. I know there had to be a lot of molds and stuff you guys got your hands on or had made.
And, you know, the magic of that menu was that they wrote it with us. So, like, all the dishes that I thought were cool, for the most part, weren't the dishes that they picked. They picked the ones that they felt had the most impact each year for a reason. So, like, we did not just the first versions of some things, but the most important versions of some things. And, you know, so to work with those guys and send regular emails back and forth to say, like, how did you do this? Why did you do this? You know, what was the importance of the smoke foam and the spice plate and, you know, the Mark Singla tortilla? Like, all of these things, they were literally just, like, brain dumping on us. This is what's important.
And, I mean, so I did the math, and Michael and I were staying at the same hotel. I remember we were in a cab after, and I'm like, they did all of that, and I calculated how many covers you could possibly have served while that menu was up. It was a couple hundred.
We did 62 a night at 33 plates a person, and then for VIPs we could bump it to 44 plates a person, but only add 10 minutes to the meal.
No, but I mean in terms of the number of covers.
Oh yeah, 62 a night for 3 months.
Yeah, I mean that's like even 1,000? No.
No.
Yeah, I mean that's commitment.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, talk about wanting to, like, show what you can do. That, to me, that was mind-blowing. That was really mind-blowing.
That was insane.
I mean, that was like a little Everest for you guys.
Yeah, I mean, that, like...
That took a lot.
I remember when
that
Renee,
had to take a lot.
My sous chef opening next, he and I were driving to Michigan to buy antiques for the Paris menu, talking about El Bulli, and came up with the idea to do an El Bulli retrospective. And I remember pitching it to Ackett's, and
we talked about it, and eventually we did it, and it was like that was the menu that I was so excited about. And that was pivotal for us because we did that, and then we did the Sicilian menu,
right,
which was family-style share food right afterwards.
Right.
And then we did the Japanese kaiseki menu.
Yeah.
And the kaiseki menu, I think, was the first time that I was feeling like I found my own voice with food. That wasn't me recooking Alinea food.
Okay, so you just anticipated my next question. How so? Because what I was going to ask was, you know, you get to Chef de Cuisine at Alinea, but everyone, by all accounts, including Alex's stew packs on the first episode of this show, Grant was still a presence, right?
Sure.
It's not like he was just like, here's the key.
Yeah.
Don't crash the car. I mean, he was there.
Yeah. I might have been the first Chef de Cuisine to get completed dishes on the menu at Alinea.
Okay.
Like, I remember Curtis put this, like, trout and hatamogi watermelon dish on the menu. Ayu.
Yeah.
Hatamogi watermelon dish. I remember Akits came in the next day and changed the whole dish, and Curtis was like, so heartbroken by it, but Akits completely changed the presentation. He's like, that's not even the dish anymore.
And can I interrupt with a question? What's with Akits?
We always called him Chef or Akits. I don't think I've ever called him Grant in his entire life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But he also called me Baron or DCB.
That's interesting. Okay.
I don't know. We both grew up playing hockey. Maybe it's a last name thing with hockey.
So you did that. Then you do these things like El Bui. Yeah. I mean, gosh.
But like the childhood menu was still hints of Alinea, like even down to the presentations.
Yeah.
The Paris menu was just us surviving. The Thai menu, we still had like Alinea tricks. And, you know, El Bulli, all of a sudden I'm cooking someone's food that's not ours.
Right. What I was going to ask. Like, so when do you find, and then...
Well, then, so Sicily, I'd never done share food. Like, we got in a huge argument one day.
You and Akits?
Yeah, of whether or not we'd put microgreens on it. And I think Ari Bendersky from Eater was sitting with us because he wanted to do an interview with us about the Sicilian menu. And while he was there, we got in a huge argument about microgreens. And I feel like Ari was like, I'm going to go now. And he got up and left, like, during it because it was so, like, awkward. And we didn't end up using microgreens.
Good.
But
good.
Yeah, microgreens suck. But at the time,
the antithesis of...
Yeah, like we were ripping basil and throwing it on.
But right.
The argument was, is that okay? Like, are we going to allow the lack of refinement to be the refinement?
Right.
You know, because if you're really adhering to a cuisine, you have to say you're going to do that cuisine in the best way. And maybe the best way of doing it isn't modernizing it.
Right, or making it, or precision, yeah, whatever the verb would be.
Like hand of God plating, where you just sprinkle things and let them fall where they are.
Yeah.
And so coming out of that, now we're back into tasting menu format with kaiseki, and we'd never really done Japanese stuff at Alinea. We'd like hinted at it with tofu or yuba, but...
Yeah, but it wasn't a defining thing.
Yeah, I think us coming back, him coming back from Japan the first time kind of started bringing in the Japanese influence.
Okay.
But so I had almost full creative freedom because I was the only one who was... I think that was the first time we did something at that restaurant,
yeah,
that he was just as unfamiliar with as I was.
Interesting.
Because at that point, neither of us had had a kaiseki meal, you know, before we started researching.
Right.
Maybe he'd had one, but like we hadn't immersed ourselves. And so yeah. Kyle Connaughton, who's now a Single Thread, was my like... He was my sounding board and savior for that menu. On a daily basis, I would send him pictures and say things like, you can't fan that, you have to dice it because it's autumn kaiseki. Or, you can serve that course, but only if you serve this first. Or, God, you know, that color only works in spring. You can't do that color. You have to change it to this. And without Kyle, that menu would not have been what it was. Wow. But I was all of a sudden cooking something that was now in a world that we were existing in that we hadn't existed before. Mm-hmm. So I was starting to feel like that was something I was creating, not something that we were creating. And so, you know, obviously you're all sitting at the table together and you're having the conversation. So it's never a one-man operation. Like, I can tell you I created this, but we all created it, right? Like, if you and I don't have a conversation about something,
sure,
I may not have thought of it.
Yeah.
So there was no, like, moment of I'm the defining thing.
But, yes.
There was that menu that led into the Hunt menu, which led into the Vegan menu, which those three were the ones I felt like I was finding my voice and my style, which in retrospect, I was also probably hurting Next, because the whole premise by Next was this constant change. And
also kind of subordinating yourselves to like a theme.
Yeah.
Right. And like it wasn't meant as a showcase for one chef's style. It was meant as like,
like a laboratory almost,
sure.
Or to me a museum. Like,
well, like the best Eleni, thing we could have done.
The Elbowy dinner was like going to an edible museum.
Yeah, totally. The best thing that I could have done for Next was going from a Sicilian menu to a Kaiseki tasting menu to take out burgers.
Right.
To, you know,
Americana.
You know, like 1920 something else.
Right.
But I wasn't doing that anymore. I was trying food from movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything.
Cinema and, food.
Yeah. And those three menus in, you know, again, in retrospect, they were basically the same menu done from three different perspectives.
Yeah.
Right. They were three different genres, but they were like 16 courses, X amount of time, X amount of this and that. And so the rebuttal to that was being pushed to do the steakhouse menu or the Bocuse d'Or menu.
Right.
Or, you know, departing completely from that, which, you know, at that point, all of a sudden, I'm uncomfortable with and pushing against. So, yeah, so at that point, I was trying to push towards what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And probably to a little bit of detriment, not pushing the restaurant in the direction it should have been going.
Right.
And I think that's the point where I was like, maybe this is where I'm realizing now it's time for me to grow.
Yes.
And start to understand what I want to do.
Yes.
In a direction separate from this current restaurant.
Why Santa Monica?
Oh, God. So I spent about 2 years... I had a great conversation with Stu Pack one day,
uh-huh.
And he basically told me the story of when he was working on Empeón. People would ask him what Empeón was, and he would say, it's not like this, and it is like that, and it's not like this. And the way he explained it, what he was realizing is that he wasn't describing Empeón, he was describing all the restaurants it was or wasn't.
Mm.
And it's like describing your kid and saying, my kid isn't like Tommy, and is kind of like Susie, and is sort of like Joe, but you're not talking about your kid.
Yeah.
And so he spent all his time understanding what Empeón was. So I spent the next 2.5 years trying to write what my restaurant was going to be, not naming another restaurant and just trying to live in that headspace, which meant exploring other cities and trying to bring this full finished packet that said, like, this is where it should be and why it should be. And I looked at New York and I looked at San Francisco. I was helping Coach Bocuse. So I was always in San Francisco and Yountville area. I love New York, and this is where I initially wanted to be, so I was like trying to find the right way to do it here.
Right. I have to just say, Bocuse was the Bocuse d'Or competition. They train, well, the only training facility, really, for the most part, was in Yountville.
Yeah, it was Thomas's dad's house.
Yeah, two doors over from the French Laundry, which they call the Bocuse house. So that's what that was. Yes. Yeah.
So I was there every 8 weeks for like a couple years, almost every 8 to 10 weeks.
Yeah.
And so... You know, I knew I wanted to be coastal. I knew I wanted to focus on, like, I was falling in love with the produce, everything we were finding. It's like all the things we were ordering were right there. Like, I could go pick whole plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, I'd approached them with this idea. I'd been looking at L.A. One of the things that drew me in was this notion that L.A. was this kind of younger, more emerging dining scene. It was feeling a lot like early 2000 Chicago, which is what made me fall in love with cooking at first. And, my business partner lived in L.A., so I was visiting him. My current business partner. Mm-hmm. At the time, he wasn't. And so I had approached Ackett's and Kokonis with this idea for this restaurant. And it wasn't that I went after him. We all sat down together and discussed it.
Because
The plan was always to write this concept and work with them on it. And, you know, I think ultimately they had too much on their plate. I wanted to go in a different direction with it. We ultimately parted. And so my, you know, my closest friend, Mike, who is now my business partner, he's in the entertainment world, the movie side. And so he's a creative. And so he was just a sounding board for me to talk about creative ideas with.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the business side, his dad would help me write the business model so that I had a finished product to show to them. And so when we all decided not to work together, Mike and his family were like, well, we've basically written all of this with you. So we would be interested in working with you. And you know, I'd spent a couple of years visiting LA and really not liking it and mainly not understanding it. You know, I was coming out of a warehouse in the meatpacking district in Chicago and going to Encino to visit him, which is like, you know, suburbs with buildings 2-story high. Yeah, he's got like a white picket fence and a pool and a detached garage. Yeah. And I had a loft, you know, we just different lives.
Yeah.
And so after a couple of years, you know, I friends like Jordan Kahn and, you know, Tim Hollingsworth and just a lot of friends who had restaurants in LA were trying to encourage me to come out there. And I knew that...
What was the pitch?
We could do something great in the city and look at the produce and look at what's here. And it was just people who were excited about where they were.
Yeah.
And friends, you know, and I was really excited about the potential of the city and the opportunity for a great community, and I was seeing the produce. And one of the biggest things we wanted to push for in our company was culture. And you know, the challenge of the hospitality industry is it's so outward facing. You do everything you can to take care of your diners, and then you destroy each other internally. You know, if you look at the last year or so, with everything that came to fruition with like all of the sexual harassment stuff, it's not a new thing.
No,
but like not to and not to downplay that, because I'm not, but that's just like the tip of the iceberg and all of the bad things that have been happening in the restaurant industry for so long, right? Like, and it's not just like the abusive things, it's how we abuse ourselves. We stay out late, you drink too much, you know, there's a whole drug problem, there's people coming in like, you know, the pay is low, you have nothing. Like when I started working at Lenny, my salary was 19.5, I think. Maybe it was 20,000. It was something. I remember I got my first paycheck and I think it was $683 for two weeks.
Yeah.
You know, and so whatever that equates to for a salary, that's what my paycheck was. Yeah. And you know, jobs like that, the day you start the timer, or the day you start is the day you start the timer for when you have to quit. And I didn't want to do that anymore. And so we wanted an opportunity to be in a city where you could put, you could look internally first at hospitality and how do we take care of each other and how do you make your staff's life better? And then how do you write a business model around that in a city that will support it? And I wanted a younger, more exciting, ambitious dining scene to do that in, where you could also look at quality of life and you could look at how you pay people, and we could, you know, pay for their parking and pay for their transportation,
right,
or just do something to make their life better for what they could do at work, but how we could pay them and what they could do with their money outside. I just, you know, I feel like if you're going to go on your own and really take the risk and do something, you have to make it count. And I'm not going to say by any means that we're going to change the world or change the industry, or, but if you're not going to try, then what's the point?
Yeah.
We wanted to set ourselves up for an opportunity where we could actually try to do something different and better and try to make an impact. And, you know, it comes down to every aspect of it. You can't just look at, we have better hospitality, we do a better job with the diners. It's like, we profit share with our dishwashers. Like right now we do, you know, we profit share with our whole staff. Like all these little things to say, like, we're going to do everything we can to make all of our lives better.
Do you, what else do you do there that you're proud of?
On this front.
On the non-culinary, I mean, non-service front.
You know, I think one of the most exciting things that we did was immediately have a transparent policy of open books. We sit with our entire staff every month and go over the P&L with them, and everyone gets a copy to go with. And, you know, 7-8 months in, we started taking turns with the staff. Like, okay, it's your month. You want to do the P&L this month? Here you go.
Wow.
As soon as we paid off the restaurant, we profit shared with them. Once we profit shared and they understood the P&L, then they were proactive about making the restaurant more functional.
Has that resulted, do you think, in less turnover and more loyal staff loyalty than people are seeing across the board these days?
We haven't lost anyone.
You haven't lost anyone?
No. And we're expanding, and everyone worked together in Chicago, and we're expanding, and more people are coming who we worked with in the past.
No one's left since opening?
One dishwasher. Sorry, two dishwashers.
Holy shit. I'm sorry.
And one dishwasher, it was just the commute was too much.
Has that story been written?
I don't know.
That's an unbelievable detail in the current marketplace in a big city in this country when people are advertising major restaurants. We were talking about Greg Backstrom. He's got like almost as one of the hottest restaurants in New York.
Yeah.
They're all the time on Instagram with like their whole benefits package.
Yeah.
That's typical.
And, you know, we provide health insurance and you know, competitive wages. We're no tipping restaurants that we can pay everyone. We don't have like the service fee. We just pay people. And, you know, when you come in and you buy dinner, your only extra fee is your tax. That's it. And you know, we wanted to treat it like every other industry, not like the restaurant industry. So I mean, granted, like,
well,
it's a little
the
restaurant
best
with
of
nine
other
employees.
Industries. Yeah, so, I understand, but
yeah,
I mean,
you have to start somewhere.
No, but still, to not, I mean, you know what, it's cutthroat right now to hold on to people.
So, and as we're expanding, we have more people. Like our new hire at Dialogue and our new hire as sous chef at the new place, he worked with us at Next. He worked with the chef who's going to be the chef at Pajali at another restaurant in LA. And he was at Single Thread for last year. And his wife, who is also at Single Thread, is going to be at Dialogue now. Like, you're bringing people back in that you've developed relationships with, who are then bringing people in that they have relationships with. And you're growing a brand around the people that matter, not around, you know, how you get people in. It's not about keeping people. It's about building a good culture. And that culture will keep the people.
So explain to people, what does the name of the restaurant is Dialogue. And what does it mean?
It's had an evolving name. So, you know, it wasn't the original name for the restaurant. And the original name for the restaurant was a different concept. So we scrapped it because this wasn't that.
And we kept talking about the restaurant, the importance of the interaction and with the kitchen, with the service team, with the space, and the name dialogue just kept coming up. The word dialogue did. Like, we kept saying the dialogue between this, and our dialogue with the diner was important because we were building a relationship with the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it just stuck, and it named itself. So the initial was because we were talking to everyone, and it was all about the dialogue.
Yeah.
What it's evolved into now is, I think that name a year later now reflects that this restaurant has become our dialogue with Southern California and how mm-hmm. we are interacting and learning from it. So an evolving name that's taken on many meanings.
Uh-huh. And so what's changed in coming up on 2 years?
I think we now, a year in, are starting to understand how to tell the story we want to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at first it was like, we know what we're doing, but we're not quite sure why we're doing it yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the more you do it, and the more you talk about it, the more you live with it. And the fact that we change everything every 3 months forces you to reassess why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think every step is a step towards the goal of us understanding what it is that this restaurant wants to become.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's almost by nature of the name, right? Like, it feels like you had to have had that learning curve.
I mean, that's the that's the point of a conversation.
Right.
It continues.
Right, yeah.
You know, it evolves.
Yeah. So you needed to be a little ways in on that before it really revealed what it would be, because you needed the other side of the conversation.
I mean, we had a point where we thought every time we do a new menu, we say, this is our best menu. And the next one is, this is our best menu. I don't think any of them are our best menu. I think each one is just us having a better relationship with that menu, and that we're understanding more about ourselves as a restaurant
mm-hmm.
and about the food that we want to serve and our level, our confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you ate menu 2 and ate menu 7, it's a world different. But if you ate 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, every time it's just like turning the next page or the next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's the importance of the restaurant for us.
And that's natural, right? Don't you think? I mean,
yes and no. I mean, I think a lot of restaurants, you know, you develop your staples and you hold on to those.
Yes. No, I meant for things that change.
If they don't, then how are you evolving?
I mean, one of the most something that's really stuck in my head forever. I've brought it up in other interviews. I remember interviewing David Kinch about the Man Racer cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes about 2 years to do a book. You get a year to write it, roughly, and then it takes about a year for them to put it together, you know, art directed, copy edited, all that stuff. And so he told me that by the time that book came out, the restaurant was the food was in a whole different place. From when he wrote the book, right? So this is my secret belief is that this is why chefs want to write cookbooks, is because what you do is so transient, so fleeting. Literally,
you need to preserve that. I mean,
well, it's your only shot at immortality as a chef, right? Unless Corey's going to feature you at In Situ, or they're going to feature you at Next one day. Like,
that's it. Yeah.
You don't leave with like a painting on a wall.
No, and you know it's one of those few. When people refer to it as art, it's like the only tangible art. Like, you eat it, you consume it, it's gone.
Yes,
it's more of a craft than an art.
It is. Although I've
right? come, like, you make a lot of tables the same way. You only make one painting.
I agree with that, and yes, I think technically yes, but I've also come to, dialogue's the perfect word to sum up what I'm about to say, because every night the food is made anew every night, mm-hmm. It's different people in the dining room every night eating it, and then it's gone, right? But that moment between your team, whoever's, you know, front of house, if there is a front of house, and the diners, mm-hmm. right, that dynamic and that food, even if it's the same menu as the day before, that execution of it, that only exists amongst those people.
Sure, and our restaurant is so transparent that even the diners seating to seating make the room feel different.
Yeah.
So like every moment in that restaurant will never be repeated.
And that to me is what takes it above craft. Most craft, you know, like you said, you know, like most craft, like somebody makes a table, the table survives, you know, most craft survives.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the thing to me that takes it to another place. It's the dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's the exchange that happens on a given night. It's that.
That's a weird thing.
It's the alchemy. It's the alchemy, right? And that's never the same. And that to me is what takes it almost to a whole other place. That I spent a lot of time on the first year and a half of this show being hung. We had a lot of conversations. Well, from day one with Stupak, mm-hmm. from the first show, about art versus craft. What is cooking?
Yeah.
And I've kind of let go of it because it's like, does it have to fit into one of those?
It's always like the drunk argument at the bar: are we artists or craftsmen?
Right. It's, you know, and that's,
it's
fun.
Like a long like battle, like,
and
oh,
that's
I
fun.
This and that, yeah.
It's like the performance. Like, what's a performance in theater? Is that art or is that a craft?
Yeah.
But I would argue that the magic of it is,
if you're into if you go to theater and you can, like, I can say I saw Dustin Hoffman in Death of a Salesman in 1980, whatever. If you weren't there, you will never know.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes it something that it just adds something special to me that it was there and it's not, it's just in your memory.
Sure. I mean, I think about my meal at Abuli all the time. Yeah. Can't ever have that again.
All right. So before we wrap up, tell me about the new place, which may, well, yeah, won't be open by the time this airs. But
no, it'll be open.
You'll be probably halfway from now to opening.
Late August, early September.
Yeah, we're sitting here in the second week of June.
So we've, you know, the original restaurant we were going to open in L.A. was a huge space in an old bank. It was like 10,000 square feet. It had a higher-end a la carte French. It had a 28-seat fine dining.
Yeah.
As that was like, lease was falling apart. I was losing love with it. It felt like an ego trip of a restaurant that was selfish. It didn't feel like it was anything for the city.
Yeah.
And so that's where Dialogue was born out of that 28-seat restaurant, where it's like, uh-huh, this restaurant will start the relationship with the city. And yeah. But I always wanted to pursue that French place. And I always use this analogy of the movie versus the play.
Yes.
And so if we're talking about a library, you have, you know, if we're making a movie about it, you care about the wear patterns in the carpet and the top right book on the back third bookshelf. The whole scene matters because the story is what happens within that scene when you're watching the movie. But in a play, that same library is now one bookshelf, one table, one lamp.
Uh-huh.
And your mind fills in the blanks.
Yep.
And so that was Dialogue. Dialogue is the play set where the story is on the plate in front of you. So the other half of that was always the a la carte French place, because I love cooking classic French.
Yeah.
I love eating that style of thing. It's a restaurant that I have fallen in love with so many times.
Yeah.
And that's the movie, in the sense that we create the entire framework because the diner writes their story with the a la carte menu.
Yeah.
So we create the where they can do that, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, my background was tasting menus, but also French food. And it's like that restaurant that I love it. Like, elevated neighborhood bistro. All the things, like the duck press is one of my all-time favorite courses.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I can't wait to wheel carts around that dining room and press ducks.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it's going to be fun and cool.
It's great.
Like, a great place with delicious food that is less about the weight of people's idea of classic French and more about that Parisian market aspect, because we have a market and it's phenomenal. And so...
But that food also to me is like, I don't know. It's like enough to make you believe in like destiny or
it's soulful.
It's perfect though. I remember there was a Bourdain episode of I think it might have been the Bocuse one or the Lyon one
when he and Danielle were
But they bring out and they but also when they go to the restaurant and they bring out these platters.
Oh yeah.
And Bourdain was like, "This is perfect. Look at the colors and the, you know." It's perfect. It's almost like the Ten Commandment tablets.
Yeah.
It just seemed like it's just like that's how food was meant to be, and it'll never be better than that.
Yeah. It's
there's something just inevitable.
It's the
and,
foundation of what made me fall in love with food.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and cooking it. It's you're so in tune with it because you have to be touching it. You have to be feeling it and listening to it. And that's the kind of food that when you cook it, it's an extension of you.
Yeah. I look forward to going to both your places. We tried to get together when I was out there, but it didn't happen. Well, this has been a long interview. Thank you for doing it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad we were able to work it out today.
We survived.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
And that's our show for this week. Kevin, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I think you are a newish listener, so I don't know if you know, I hate doing intros by myself. This part of the show, the interstitial material, the outro, it's much easier for me to talk to another person.
No, I dig it. Any time we're hanging out at a mysterious location.
You're happy to do it? Maybe you'll come on as a guest sometime and do one of our open kitchen non-chef interviews.
I would love to just open up the vault of stories.
That would be great.
I got all kinds.
Well, we have a surprising amount of stuff in common.
We have friends in common.
Friends in common. We have a love of movies, we've discovered.
Big love.
We've been throwing quotes at each other for a day and a half.
We have.
And
maybe we'll make a movie together.
Maybe we'll make a movie. Stranger things have happened. Dave Barron, thank you so much for sticking with me that crazy day in New York. I'm glad we got that interview in. Susan Hosmer, ditto for you for helping make that happen. Again, a thank you to Hillary Sterling of Vic's Restaurant.
Can I just say, Dave Barron is an incredibly talented chef and a great human being, and you should go see him.
Yes.
I'm a fan.
You can do that at Dialogue.
And his new restaurant, Pajoli, is going to be opening sometime in the next month, month and a half. Keep an eye out for that if you're in the Santa Monica area. G. Paul, our engineer, thanks to you for splicing this thing together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And we'll see you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening!